"Boring," Lord Rupert Ainslie said. And because the orchestra had paused between dances, the word carried farther than cruelty usually dared to travel. Lady Honora Ellsworth stood with one gloved hand resting on the edge of a marble-topped refreshment table in Lady Harbury's ballroom, where 300 candles shone upon silk, diamonds, polished shoulders, and the pitiless curiosity of London society. For one still second, no one moved. A footman holding a tray of lemonade lowered his eyes. Two debutantes near the fern case pretended to study their dance cards. Lady Cressida Vane lifted her painted fan just high enough to hide a smile. Honora had heard unkind things before, plain, sensible, useful, safe. Those words had followed her through four seasons like elderly chaperones who never tired. But boring was different. Boring meant she had not merely failed to enchant. It meant there was nothing in her worth discovering. She could have pretended not to hear. Most women in her position survived by becoming gracefully deaf. Yet the word had struck too cleanly, and the room had heard too much. Lord Rupert stood 12 feet away in a coat of dark blue superfine, his fair hair arranged with careless art, his expression bright with that polished boredom only privileged men considered charm. He had written his name on Honora's card earlier that evening for the country dance after supper. Her mother had seen it. Her aunt had seen it. Even Honora, though she knew better than to hope easily, had allowed herself one private breath of relief. Lord Rupert was the second son of the Marquess of Brackmere, not wealthy in his own right. Perhaps, but well-connected, handsome, and approved by every person who thought a woman of 27 should be grateful for approval. Rupert, Lady Cressida murmured, making his name sound like a rebuke and an invitation at once.
"You're wicked,"
he replied, glancing once toward Honora and then away, as if she were already a chair he had decided not to sit in. "Only honest. Miss Vane, do tell me you wouldn't wish me to spend an entire set discussing parish accounts and improving pamphlets."
"I'd perish," Cressida said. The fan trembled with laughter.
Honora felt the heat climb from the base of her throat to her cheeks. She did not raise a hand to hide it. That, at least, she would not give them. Across the ballroom, the chandeliers burned like judgment. The floor had been swept to a mirror shine. Mothers watched behind feathers. Young ladies watched behind eyelashes. Gentlemen watched with the faint amusement of men, pleased that the evening had offered them a story. Honora had been brought up to understand the exact cost of making a scene. A lady did not answer insult with temper. A lady did not expose her pain for public inspection. A lady stood still while others decided whether she had been wounded enough to be interesting. Her father, the Earl of Selborne, stood near the card room doors, deep in conversation with an older gentleman, and happily unaware that his daughter had just become the evening's amusement. Her mother, Lady Selborne, was seated with the dowagers, her tired eyes fixed on the dancers, as if willing one of them to choose Honora and rescue the family from another season of polite disappointment. Honora could have gone to her, she could have complained, she could have allowed maternal indignation to wrap around her like a shawl. Instead, she lowered her gaze to her dance card. Lord Rupert's name rested there in neat black ink. The sight of it embarrassed her more than the insult. It was proof that for a few foolish hours she had believed courtesy might mean intention. Rupert stepped closer, no longer smiling quite so openly. Perhaps even he had realized the silence had sharpened. "Lady Honora," he said, bowing with perfect correctness, "I fear I must beg release from our dance. Lady Cressida has reminded me of a prior claim." "A prior claim?" Honora looked at him. Not at his polished boots, or his jeweled pin, or the smooth mouth that had made cruelty sound almost accidental. She looked directly into his eyes. They were not sorry. That steadied her. Pain was harder to bear when it asked to be forgiven. "Of course," she said. Her voice came out calm enough to disappoint half the room. "I should hate to detain a gentleman where he finds no interest." Cressida's fan stopped moving. Rupert's smile thinned. "You understand, then?" "Perfectly." Honora held out the dance card. "You may remove your name, Lord Rupert.
I would not wish my card to misrepresent your courage. A breath moved through the nearest listeners. Not loud, not yet scandal, but enough. Rupert's hand paused. For the first time that evening, something uncertain touched his face. Then pride restored him. He took the small pencil attached to Honora's card by a narrow blue ribbon and dragged one careless line through his name. The pencil was blue enamel, no longer fashionable, its silver cap worn smooth by years of use. It had belonged to Honora's late grandmother, a woman who had once told her that quiet girls must keep sharp pencils, because the world would often forget to give them a voice. When Rupert released the card, the pencil slipped free from its ribbon and fell to the floor. It landed without drama near the hem of Honora's pale gray gown. She heard it. Rupert did not. Cressida did, but she merely glanced down and away, as if even noticing the fallen object would be too generous. "Enjoy the supper, Lady Honora," Rupert said. Then he offered his arm to Cressida and walked away. There it was. The small death of a public hope. No thunder accompanied it. No curtain fell. The orchestra began again with a bright flourish, almost insulting in its cheer. Couples formed. Silk skirts turned. Laughter resumed, because society had a remarkable talent for stepping around another person's humiliation without missing the rhythm. Honora remained where she stood. Her fingers closed around the dance card until its gilt edge pressed into her glove. She did not bend for the pencil at once. To bend would make the moment visible again. To reach for the little blue object, while half the room wondered whether she might cry, would be to perform the role they had prepared for her. Poor Lady Honora. Sensible Lady Honora. Boring Lady Honora, abandoned beside the lemonade, she breathed in slowly. The air smelled of beeswax, hothouse roses, warm silk and sugar. Her stays held her upright when pride alone might have failed. At last, when the watchers began to tire, she lowered her hand, as if merely smoothing her skirt, and prepared to retrieve what was hers. Another hand reached first. It was a man's hand, gloved in immaculate white, long-fingered, steady, and unhurried. He picked up the pencil with the care one might give a dropped jewel. Honora straightened so quickly that the room seemed to tilt. The gentleman before her was tall, dark-haired, and dressed with a restraint more commanding than display. His evening coat was black, his waistcoat white, his cravat tied without vanity. He wore no excessive ornament. He did not need any. Power sat on him quietly, like a cloak made for his shoulders alone. Honora knew him by sight, as every person in the ballroom did. His Grace Tobias Fairborn, Duke of Locksley, had entered Lady Harbury's ball half an hour earlier and altered the atmosphere without raising his voice. Mothers had shifted their daughters toward him. Gentlemen had made space. Hostesses had brightened with calculation. He was 36, unmarried, scholarly in reputation, difficult to flatter, and wealthy enough that even the boldest gossip softened when speaking his name. A duke in a crowded room was not merely a man. He was a verdict society wished to earn. He held out the pencil. "I believe this belongs to you, Lady Honora." She had not expected him to know her name. That was her first mistake. Her second was allowing surprise to show. "Your Grace," she said, curtsing because manners remained when certainty did not. "Thank you." He did not immediately release the pencil. Not because he meant to keep it, but because his attention had settled on the narrow blue ribbon still hanging broken from her card. "A useful instrument," he said. "It seems a pity that it was treated carelessly." A dangerous warmth moved behind Honora's ribs. She warned herself against it. A woman could survive insult if she did not grow foolish over kindness. Small things are often treated carelessly in crowded rooms, only by those who mistake size for value. His voice was low enough that the words did not travel far, yet something in his composure made the nearest guests lean without meaning to. Honora took the pencil. Their gloved fingers did not touch. Still, she felt the almost of it, and that was worse. "You are very gracious, Your Grace." "No," he said, "only observant." The answer unsettled her. Compliments were manageable when they were false. One could smile at them, deflect them, and set them aside. Observation was harder. It suggested evidence. It suggested he had seen her humiliation and had not looked away. Behind him, Lord Rupert had reached the far side of the ballroom with Lady Cressida. He was laughing again, though not as easily as before. Honora could feel him attempting not to glance back. "I fear you have arrived at an unfortunate corner of the evening," she said. "On the contrary." The Duke's gaze moved briefly to the crossed-out name on her dance card, then returned to her face. "I find it clarifies the room." A faint, unwilling breath escaped her. It was not quite laughter. It was too wounded for that, and too surprised. His expression did not change, but his eyes noticed. That was when Honora understood the danger of him. Not that he was a duke. Not that he was handsome in the severe, thoughtful way of portraits in old houses. The danger was that he seemed to hear the words people swallowed. "You are kind to say so," she replied. "I'm not kind when accuracy will do." Because it was dialogue, the contraction sounded natural, almost startling from a man so controlled. Honora glanced down, afraid that if she looked at him too long, the ballroom would begin inventing stories she was not strong enough to endure. "Then accuracy requires me to admit that I have been abandoned for the next dance." "Abandoned," he repeated, "an imprecise word. It suggests loss." She looked up. "And what would your grace call it?" The Duke turned his head slightly. Across the room, Rupert finally looked back. His smile faltered when he saw who stood before Honora. The shift was small, but it was enough to satisfy some stern place in her that she had not known was waiting. Tobias Fairbairn saw it too. "A correction," he said. The orchestra ended its lively tune. Applause scattered through the room. Couples separated, and the brief disorder before the next set opened around them like a held breath. The Duke inclined his head. "Lady Honora, may I have the next dance?" The question was perfectly proper. It was also impossible. Somewhere nearby, a woman whispered. Someone else stopped mid-sentence. Honora felt the entire ballroom swing toward her, not with pity this time, but with disbelief. Her mother had risen halfway from her chair. Lady Cressida's fan had frozen again. Lord Rupert looked as if he had just discovered that a door he had closed opened into a grander room than the one he had chosen. Honora's first instinct was to protect the Duke from the absurdity of his own offer. "Your Grace, you cannot mean me." His answer came without hesitation. "I do." She felt the blue pencil in her palm, small and hard and real. For years she had been careful not to ask much of any room she entered. Space enough to stand, courtesy enough to pass. A dance, if someone remembered. Now the most powerful gentleman present waited, as if her answer mattered more than the room's astonishment. Honora raised her chin. "Then yes, Your Grace." "I would be honored." Tobias offered his arm. She placed her gloved hand upon it. The contact was light, proper, and witnessed. It still changed the evening. As he led her toward the floor, the crowd made way. No one called her boring now. No one called her anything at all. That silence followed her like a new title. Behind them, Lord Rupert Ainslie stood with Lady Cressida's hand on his sleeve, and watched the woman he had dismissed walk into the center of the ballroom beside the Duke of Locksley. Honora did not look back. She did not need to. The blue pencil rested safely in her other hand, and for the first time that evening, she allowed herself the smallest smile. The first step onto the ballroom floor felt less like movement than exposure. Honora had crossed polished floors before, had taken partners whose attention wandered before the music began, had smiled through quadrilles with gentlemen who spoke to her only when etiquette required it. This was different. This time, every candle seemed to brighten, every whisper seemed to lean toward her. The Duke of Locksley guided her into place with a composure so complete that the room itself appeared to obey it. He did not hurry. He did not look around to see who watched. His attention remained on her, and that was the most unsettling courtesy Honora had ever received. A woman could prepare herself for ridicule. She could brace against pity. She could even survive indifference, if indifference was familiar enough. But careful attention from a man who had no reason to give it was another matter entirely. "Your Grace," she said softly as the musicians lifted their bows, I must warn you that half the room believes you have made a mistake.
Only half? He asked. The faint dryness of his tone almost startled a laugh from her. She contained it, but not quickly enough.
His gaze touched her mouth for a fraction of a second, then returned to her eyes with impeccable restraint.
Then I have disappointed the other half by being less interesting than they hoped. I don't think London is often disappointed by you.
London mistakes scarcity for merit.
And do you?
No. I make my own mistakes. The music began. The waltz opened with a measured tenderness that seemed cruelly ill-suited to a room so hungry for spectacle. Tobias placed one hand at the proper distance along her side, light enough to satisfy any dowager, and steady enough to assure her she would not be allowed to falter.
Honora set her hand in his. Their gloves formed a thin barrier of white kid leather, yet the steadiness of him traveled through it.
They turned, the floor widened, the watchers blurred.
For one impossible measure, Honora forgot to wonder whether she looked foolish.
You dance very well, he said.
That is a dangerous compliment to give a woman who has just been accused of having no charms.
Dancing is not a charm.
It is discipline.
Then I may accept the compliment.
You should.
She looked at him with quick surprise.
Most gentlemen offered compliments as coins tossed into a beggar's cup, bright, careless, meant to prove generosity rather than attention.
Tobias Fairbairn spoke as if accuracy mattered.
It made each word harder to dismiss.
You speak as though you know me, she said.
I know you did not look toward your mother when Lord Rupert insulted you.
Honora nearly missed a step.
He adjusted at once, so smoothly that no one watching could have seen it.
Forgive me, he said.
That was too direct.
It was, but not untrue.
No. The single syllable cost her more than a longer answer would have.
They turned past a pair of young ladies who pretended to watch the chandeliers.
Honora could feel curiosity pressing against her skin.
I did not look, because my mother would have suffered more visibly than I did, she said.
And because if I had allowed her to rescue me, everyone would have remembered only that I needed rescue.
You object to rescue.
I object to being made smaller by it.
His hand remained perfectly steady,
a useful distinction.
Useful. She let the word settle between them.
That is one of the kinder things people call me.
Do you dislike being useful?
No.
I dislike being valued only when I am convenient.
For the first time, something in his expression changed.
Not pity. Pity would have made her retreat.
This was recognition, quiet and grave, as if she had set down a piece of evidence, and he had understood the case it belonged to.
Then Lord Rupert is a poorer judge than I first believed.
You know Lord Rupert.
I know his family.
I know his reputation.
I know that men who laugh too readily in public often calculate more carefully in private.
Honora's fingers tightened before she could prevent it.
That is a severe observation.
I have been told I collect them.
And have you collected one about me?
He did not answer at once.
They moved through the turn, her skirt sweeping lightly over the floor, the silk whispering against the polished boards.
A chandelier shimmered above them.
Somewhere beyond his shoulder, Lady Cressida watched with her fan lowered, her beauty sharpened by disbelief.
Lord Rupert stood beside her, and the amusement had gone out of his face.
He looked not wounded, exactly, but deprived, as if Honora had taken something from him by accepting what he had thrown away.
She should not have cared.
She told herself she did not.
Then Tobias turned her through the next figure, and Rupert vanished from her line of sight.
My observation, the Duke said, is that you choose your words with care, because others have been careless with theirs.
Honora's breath caught.
The music carried them forward before she could defend herself.
A lady trained for society learned to dodge sincerity with a laugh, to hide vulnerability behind modesty, to allow men to believe they had discovered nothing, when in fact they had never looked.
Tobias had looked once and found too much.
That sounds rather serious for a waltz, she said.
Would you prefer nonsense?
Most gentlemen seem to.
Most gentlemen are frightened of silence.
They fill it with nonsense and call themselves agreeable.
This time she did laugh, quietly enough that only he could hear.
The sound seemed to surprise him,
It surprised her more. It was not the brittle laugh she used when an aunt made a despairing joke about unmarried daughters. It was not the dutiful laugh expected at dinner. It was brief and real, and because it was real it frightened her. Tobias saw that too, of course. He seemed to see everything. "There," he said. "There what? That is the first honest sound I have heard in this room tonight." Honora looked away, but the smile came before she could stop it. It was small. It did not ask permission. It did not apologize for existing. Across the ballroom, Lord Rupert saw it. Honora knew the exact instant because his expression altered as sharply as if someone had spoken his name aloud. His gaze moved from her face to the Duke's hand, from the Duke's hand to the easy distance between them, then back to her smile. He had expected humiliation to make her shrink. He had not expected anyone, least of all the Duke of Locksley, to draw her into the center of the room and make her appear not rescued, but revealed. "Lord Rupert is watching," Tobias said. Honora's smile faded slightly. "I am aware. Does it trouble you?" "It should not. That was not my question." Another turn. Another sweep of sound. Honora could have lied. Instead, perhaps because his voice made falsehood feel undignified, she gave him a smaller truth. "A little. Not because I want him to regret me. No, because I dislike that he can still measure whether I am hurt." The Duke's expression became still. "Then do not give him the privilege. Is that a command, Your Grace?" "No, an invitation." She looked at him then, really looked, and found no mockery. The room remained full of eyes, full of judgment, full of women who would repeat every gesture, and men who would pretend not to care while remembering all of it. Yet inside the circle of the dance, Tobias had created a narrow and improbable shelter. "Not a hiding place, a place to stand." Honora lifted her chin. "Very well," she said. "I accept." "Good. Do." "You always sound so satisfied when people obey you, only when they misunderstand me on purpose." The corner of his mouth changed, not quite a smile, but close enough to feel dangerous. Honora realized she was no longer counting the measures until the dance ended. That, too, was dangerous. When the final strain approached, regret touched her before caution could prevent it. A dance was a temporary mercy. It began, it dazzled, it ended, and society reclaimed whatever it had merely loaned. In a few seconds she would return to the edge of the room with a crossed-out dance card and a story attached to her name. The Duke must have sensed the shift. "You are preparing to disappear," he said. "I am preparing to be sensible. Those are not always the same thing. In my experience, they are safer when they are. Safety is often recommended by people who do not have to live inside it." The music ended. Applause rose, scattered and bright. Tobias released her with the exact propriety required. But he did not step away at once. He bowed. Honora curtsied. The pause between them lasted no more than a heartbeat, yet the room noticed because rooms like this were built to notice. "Lady Honora," he said, his voice low but clear enough for those nearest to hear, "I should like to call upon you tomorrow, if your family permits it." The silence that followed was more satisfying than applause would have been. Honora felt shock ripple outward. Her mother's fan stopped. A dowager leaned toward another, as if her bones had suddenly become young. Lady Cressida's face hardened beneath its careful powder. Lord Rupert's hand tightened around his gloves. Honora should have said something graceful and empty. Instead, she said the truest polite thing available. "My mother will be honored, Your Grace." "And you?" The question was too quiet for the room, but not for her. Honora's fingers closed around the blue pencil hidden in her palm. "I will be curious." For the first time that evening, the Duke of Locksley almost smiled. "Then I shall endeavor to be worth the inconvenience." He offered his arm and escorted her back, not to the shadowed corner where Rupert had abandoned her, but to Lady Selborne herself. He bowed to Honora's mother with grave respect, requested the call properly, and made no performance of triumph. That restraint made the gesture more powerful. When he finally withdrew, the crowd shifted around Honora, as though she had become a newly discovered portrait, whose value had been authenticated by an expert. Compliments arrived from women who had not spoken to her in months. Questions followed. Admiration wore the face of curiosity. Honora answered what she must and no more. Across the room, Rupert pulled Cressida toward a quieter alcove near the palms. He no longer laughed. "A duke doesn't waste attention," he said under his breath. "Find out what she knows." By noon the next day, Ellsworth House had become a house under siege by courtesy. Calling cards arrived with such frequency that the footman in the front hall looked as if he had been assigned to collect snowflakes in a storm. Lady Harbury had sent one. Lady Pembury had sent two. The second, with a note folded so sharply that it seemed to contain judgment before ink. Three matrons, who had not remembered Lady Honora Ellsworth at all during the previous month, suddenly remembered her with passionate concern. The Duke of Locksley's card lay on the silver tray apart from the others, because Lady Selborne had moved it there twice, as if proximity to lesser pasteboard might diminish its power. Honora stood at the drawing-room window and watched the carriages pass along the damp Mayfair street. Morning light softened the bricks opposite, but it did nothing to soften the noise inside the house. Her mother sat with rigid posture near the tea table, the Duke's card between her fingers. Her father, the Earl of Selborne, had retreated behind the Times, though he had not turned a page in 20 minutes. Aunt Matilda, Lady Selborne's widowed sister, embroidered with the grim concentration of a general planning a campaign. "A duke does not call without intention," Lady Selborne said for the fourth time. "A duke may call from politeness," Honora replied. "No man of Locksley's consequence spends politeness where it will be misunderstood," her mother lowered her voice. "My dear, you must consider what this could mean." Honora looked down at her own hands. She had worn fresh gloves that morning, though no one had asked her to. The small vanity annoyed her. "I have considered very little else." "Then consider it wisely," Lord Selborne said from behind the newspaper. His voice carried the tired caution of a man whose estate produced less income than his pride required. "The wrong rumor can damage a lady. The right rumor can protect one." Honora turned from the window. "Am I to be protected by rumor now?" Her father lowered the paper an inch. "You know what I mean," she did. That was the sorrow of it. In society, a woman's feelings were private, but her reputation belonged to every person with a tongue. Last night, she had been mocked in public. Then she had been honored in public. By morning, the two facts had tangled until no one cared which had hurt and which had healed. They cared only what it meant. Before Lady Selborne could answer, the door opened and the butler entered with careful gravity. "Lord Rupert Ainslie, my lady." Silence fell at once. Honora felt no surprise. Only a cold, almost useful clarity. Rupert would come before the Duke if he could. A man who had lost control of a story would hurry to write the next line. Lady Selborne rose halfway, then sat again because rank demanded that Lord Rupert be received, but last night demanded that he not be welcomed too warmly. "Show him in," she said. Rupert entered dressed for morning calls in a coat of dark green, his hat and gloves held with practiced ease. In daylight, his charm appeared thinner. The brightness that had dazzled in candlelight now seemed arranged over fatigue. He bowed to Lady Selborne, then to Lord Selborne, then turned to Honora with an expression of polished regret. "Lady Honora," he said, "I hope you'll permit me a few words. Last evening ended awkwardly. Aunt Matilda made a small sound over her embroidery. It might have been a cough. It was not a cough." Honora inclined her head. "Awkwardly is a generous word," Rupert's smile tightened. "I deserve that." "I'm afraid I spoke too carelessly. You spoke clearly. Not as I meant. That is unfortunate for us both then." His eyes flickered toward her mother. "I fear the ballroom made more of it than it was. You know how people are when music pauses and conversation fails. I know how people are when cruelty entertains them." The newspaper in Lord Selborne's hands lowered another inch. Rupert's color rose, but he recovered quickly. "I came to apologize. For calling me boring or for being overheard." Lady Selborne inhaled sharply. Honora heard it and nearly softened. Then she remembered the blue pencil on the floor, Cressida's hidden smile, and the line through Rupert's name. She kept her spine straight. Rupert stepped nearer, lowering his voice as if intimacy could be manufactured by volume. For any pain I caused, truly. But you must see that His Grace's attention last night has made matters delicate. I wouldn't want you to mistake a public kindness for something more substantial. That struck the room differently. Even Lord Selborne folded the newspaper now. Honora's embarrassment burned, but anger moved beneath it, clean and bracing. Kindness would have been more than you managed. Rupert went still. For one second, his pleasant face emptied, and something sharper looked through. Then the drawing-room door opened again. The butler stood there as if Providence had put on livery. His Grace the Duke of Locksley. Tobias Fairborn entered without haste, and the atmosphere changed so completely that Honora understood for the first time how rank could become architecture. The room rearranged itself around him. Lady Selborne rose at once. Lord Selborne did the same, newspaper forgotten. Rupert bowed, a little too quickly. Tobias returned the greetings with exact courtesy, then looked at Honora. Not at the mother who could grant permission, not at the father who could approve strategy. At Honora. Lady Honora, he said. I hope I have not called at an inconvenient hour. Rupert's jaw moved before his smile returned. Your Grace. We were just discussing last evening. Were you? Tobias removed his gloves with measured calm. Then I am grateful I arrived before the subject was exhausted. Lady Selborne fluttered toward the tea table. Your Grace, please, do sit. We are honored. Tobias accepted the chair offered to him, but only after Honora was seated. Rupert remained standing a moment too long, then took the place nearest the mantel. It made him look like a guest, hoping to be mistaken for family. Lord Rupert has been kind enough to explain that the ballroom misunderstood him, Honora said. The Duke's gaze moved to Rupert. An ambitious task. Ballrooms are rarely original, but they are often accurate. Rupert laughed lightly. London always prefers drama, doesn't it? No, Tobias said. London prefers weakness. Drama is merely the name it gives to the moment weakness becomes visible. The teacup in Lady Selborne's hand paused above its saucer. Honora looked at Tobias despite herself. He was not loud. He did not insult. Yet he had placed a blade beneath the lace of the conversation, and everyone in the room knew it was there. Rupert bowed his head by a fraction. I hope your Grace doesn't imagine I intended disrespect to Lady Honora. I do not know what you intended. Tobias accepted his tea. I know only what you did. Rupert's smile did not survive that. Honora should have felt satisfaction. Instead, she felt unease. Rupert had come with apology, but beneath it had been warning. He had spoken as if the Duke's attention might harm her, and perhaps it could. A Duke's favor was not a shawl one borrowed without consequence. It was a flame held in a room full of dry paper. Lady Selborne, eager to rescue the conversation before it became irreparable, asked after Locksley House, the health of the Duke's aunt, and the state of London roads. Tobias answered with restraint. Rupert added comments where he could, but each attempt at ease only displayed how little ease remained to him. Honora sat with the blue enamel pencil hidden in the fold of her skirt pocket. She had put it there that morning without thinking. Now its small weight reminded her that last night had not been a dream society could smooth away. At length, Rupert rose. I must not overstay. Lady Selborne, Lord Selborne, Your Grace. He turned to Honora. Lady Honora, I trust you'll accept my regret. I accept that you regret something, she said. I am not yet persuaded. We mean the same thing. Aunt Matilda's needle stopped. Tobias looked down into his tea, but Honora thought she saw the slightest change at the corner of his mouth. Rupert bowed, stiff now beneath all his polish, and withdrew. Only after his footsteps had faded did the room breathe. Lady Selborne looked as if she might scold Honora and embrace her in the same motion. Lord Selborne muttered something about young men and modern manners, though Rupert was not especially young, and his manners had been precise enough to be cruel. Tobias set down his cup. Lady Selborne, might I request a few moments of conversation with Lady Honora? In your presence, of course, the mother blinked. Yes, yes, naturally. Aunt Matilda lifted her embroidery at once. I am old enough to make propriety dull, and deaf enough to miss what I choose. Honora almost smiled, Tobias did not. He waited until her parents had settled into the far side of the room, near enough to satisfy every rule, far enough to permit words that mattered. Lord Rupert came quickly, he said. So did you, I had permission to call, so did he. No, Tobias said, he had fear. Honora looked at him. That is a severe word. It is also an accurate one. Outside, a carriage rattled over the stones. Inside, the drawing room seemed suddenly smaller. What do you believe he fears? She asked. Tobias studied her face, not with curiosity now, but with care. I hoped you might tell me what Lord Rupert would prefer you not to notice. Honora's first impulse was to deny knowledge. She had been trained to make herself harmless, and harmless women did not admit they had seen too much. But the memory came at once. Rupert's mention of her family finances, his sudden cruelty, his quick arrival, the way his eyes had sharpened when she answered him. He spoke today as if he knew something of my father's difficulties, she said. Many know that estate struggle. Did he speak like many? No, Tobias nodded once. Then we begin there, the word we moved through her more dangerously than any compliment. Before she could answer, the front door opened below. Male voices sounded in the hall, one anxious and low. Tobias turned his head slightly. Through the window, Honora saw Rupert pause beside the pavement, speaking to a narrow-shouldered clerk, with a leather folio clutched to his chest. The clerk looked frightened. Rupert looked furious. Then the young man glanced up at Ellsworth House, and for one brief second his eyes met Honora's through the glass. Tobias saw him too. That, the Duke said quietly, is not a social call. The clerk's frightened glance remained with Honora longer than Lord Rupert's insult had, because fear had a different weight from cruelty. Cruelty could be polished, rehearsed, and made presentable beneath candlelight. Fear came naked to the window and vanished before anyone could question it. By the following afternoon, when Aunt Matilda insisted that fresh air and public respectability were both necessary to prevent rumors from breeding in closed rooms, Honora entered the gallery on Bond Street with the image still pressed behind her eyes. A narrow-shouldered young man, a leather folio, Rupert's mouth tight with anger. Tobias Fairbairn had not pressed her for answers after seeing him. That restraint unsettled her, more than interrogation would have done. He had merely said that some men left footprints in the places where they believed no one would look. Then he had taken his leave with formal courtesy, as if he had not just drawn a line between last night's humiliation and something colder. The gallery was crowded enough to feel safe and dangerous at once. Paintings in gilded frames rose along the walls. Ladies drifted in clusters of silk and feathers. Gentlemen stood before landscapes and said very little about art in confident voices. Near the far end of the room, a table had been arranged for the charity committee attached to the exhibition, where patronesses collected names, pledges, and opinions with equal seriousness. Aunt Matilda guided Honora toward it with a hand on her elbow. Remember, her aunt murmured, a woman who has been discussed must be seen behaving as if discussion bores her. Honora glanced at her. Is that wisdom or warfare? At my age, my dear, they're the same thing. Honora almost smiled, but the smile faded when she saw Lady Cressida Vane standing beside a watercolor of a ruined abbey, surrounded by two young ladies and one older matron, who seemed to have appointed herself guardian of fashionable malice. Cressida wore pale rose silk, delicate as a blush and twice as calculated. She looked toward Honora with surprise that arrived too late to be sincere. Lady Honora, Cressida said, gliding closer, how brave of you to attend today. Some women would have stayed home after such a lively evening. Honora felt Aunt Matilda's fingers tighten once, then release. I have always found paintings less exhausting than speculation, Honora replied. Paintings do not require one to answer them. How fortunate, Cressida said. Though I confess, I had not known you cared for art. I supposed you preferred accounts and improving committees. One of the young ladies gave a small laugh. Honora recognized the shape of the trap. Cressida was not asking whether she had taste. She was inviting the room to agree that Honora had none. Art and accounts are not enemies, Honora said. The first gives a charity beauty. The second keeps it honest. The matron blinked. Cressida's fan opened with a snap soft enough to be graceful. How practical. I suppose that is your great gift. It is one of them. The answer came before Honora could soften it. A thin silence spread. Across the room, a gentleman turned from a portrait. Tobias Fairborn stood near the entrance, speaking with Lady Pembury, but his attention had shifted. He did not move toward Honora. He simply watched, and there was strength in being watched by someone who did not hurry to rescue what she could still defend. Cressida's smile sharpened. Then perhaps you should join the committee table. Lady Pembury is in want of ladies with sturdy handwriting. Mine is dreadful when I'm fatigued. Then you must be fatigued often, Aunt Matilda said pleasantly. Cressida's eyes cooled. Honora touched her aunt's sleeve before the exchange could become too visible. I should be glad to assist Lady Pembury. The committee table offered ledgers, pledge sheets, folded correspondence, and the sort of ordered work that had always comforted Honora, because numbers did not flatter, and ink did not pretend. Lady Pembury, a formidable woman with a sapphire brooch and a voice made for closing disputes, received Honora with visible calculation. Lady Honora, your aunt tells me you are useful with subscriptions. My aunt exaggerates only when she dislikes someone, Honora said. But yes, I can help. Lady Pembury gave a surprised little sound that might, in another woman, have been a laugh. Then sit here. We are reconciling promised gifts with received drafts. It is thankless, which means it must be done accurately. Honora took the chair offered, smoothed her gloves, and began. The work steadied her. Names moved beneath her eyes. Countess of Windmere, paid. Sir Aldous Ferron, paid in part. Lady Cressida Vane, promised through her father, pending. Brackmere family, pledged for restoration of the infirm widow's fund. The entry made her pause. Lord Rupert's name appeared beneath the larger family line, in an elegant slant she recognized from her dance card. Promised at Lady Pembury's February music hale. Not received, she read it again, not received. The amount was not ruinous for a Marquess's household, but it was large enough to matter in a public ledger, and small enough to be embarrassing if unpaid. Lady Honora, Lady Pembury asked. Is there an error? Honora lowered her pencil point to the margin. It was the blue enamel pencil, restored to its ribbon that morning by her own hand. Perhaps not an error. Only an absence. Tobias had moved nearer without making the movement obvious. He stood before a seascape several yards away, close enough to hear if one spoke clearly, far enough to satisfy propriety. Cressida lingered by the Abbey watercolor, her face turned toward a companion, but her eyes on the table. The Brackmere pledge, Honora said. Has the draft been delayed? Lady Pembury's mouth tightened. Lord Rupert assured us it had been sent through the family steward. The ledger shows otherwise, so it does. The older woman reached for a folded note, then stopped. I dislike confusion in charitable matters. Confusion is often innocent. Honora lifted the pledge sheet. But this hand is not confused. Tobias looked at her then. She felt it, though she kept her gaze on the paper. Lady Pembury lowered her voice. You know Lord Rupert's hand? He crossed it from my dance card with considerable confidence last night. Lady Pembury stared. Aunt Matilda coughed again. This time it was almost certainly not a cough. Honora's cheeks warmed, but she did not retreat. Forgive me, that was too plain. No, Lady Pembury said, after a pause. It was overdue. Before Honora could answer, Cressida approached the table in a drift of rose silk. Are we discussing subscriptions? How noble. I do hope nobody has misplaced anything important. Charity work can become so untidy when ladies take it too seriously. Honora placed the pledge sheet flat. I find charitable promises should be taken seriously by those who make them. Of course, Cressida tilted her head, though gentlemen are often busy. I'm sure Lord Rupert would be distressed to hear his name examined in public. Then he will be relieved to know I examined the ledger, not his character. A sharper silence followed. Tobias turned fully from the seascape now. Lady Pembury's eyes gleamed with the contained delight of a woman who liked a well-placed pin in an overinflated cushion. Cressida's fan fluttered once.
You have become very bold since last evening.
No, Honora said, only less willing to mistake rudeness for rank. The words landed quietly, but they landed. Cressida's color changed beneath her powder.
You misunderstand me. I am trying not to.
For the first time, Honora saw what Rupert must have feared. Not that she was brilliant in some dazzling, dangerous way. Not that she would dominate a room. She listened. She remembered. She noticed where claims did not match conduct, and where charm arrived too quickly to cover a gap. Men like Rupert could laugh at a woman for being dull, if dull meant she would never interrupt the performance. But if she read the ledger, if she kept the fallen pencil, if she remembered the wording of a note and the timing of a clerk at the door, then dull became inconvenient.
Cressida leaned closer, still smiling for the room.
Do take care, Lady Honora. Practical women are admired until they become severe, and charming women are admired until they become careless. Lady Pembury made no attempt to hide her interest now.
Tobias stepped to the edge of the table. Cressida curtsied at once, her expression transforming into sweetness with such speed that Honora almost admired the craft.
Your Grace. We were only discussing the burden of good works.
Were you?
Tobias asked. How fortunate I arrived for the improving portion, Cressida laughed.
I'm afraid Lady Honora has been instructing us all.
Then I have arrived late.
His gaze moved to Honora.
I would rather have heard the beginning.
Honora did not know where to place her hands.
The blue pencil rested between her fingers, and suddenly she became aware of it as if it were a signal flag.
There was very little beginning, Your Grace.
Only a missing payment. Small absences are sometimes instructive.
Cressida's fan stilled.
Lady Pembury drew the ledger toward herself with solemn satisfaction.
His Grace is correct. I shall write
to the Marquess of Brackmere's steward today.
Perhaps, Cressida said lightly, there is no need to trouble a steward over a clerical delay.
Charity survives by troubling the comfortable, Lady Pembury replied.
That ended the matter, at least in the room.
Cressida curtsied again and withdrew, but not before Honora saw a narrow flash of anger beneath the practiced charm.
Tobias remained beside the table. He did not praise Honora in front of everyone. He did not make her victory his own by announcing it.
He waited until Lady Pembury was occupied with another patroness, then spoke low enough for only Honora and Aunt Matilda to hear.
Stillness is not emptiness, Lady Honora. The sentence struck more deeply than compliment could have.
Honora kept her eyes on the ledger, because looking at him felt suddenly unsafe.
And silence is not consent, she said.
No, he replied. It is often evidence awaiting the right witness.
She looked up then.
The gallery noise continued around them, all silk, murmurs, and admiration for painted ruins, yet something had shifted.
Rupert's unpaid pledge was a small thing, a line in a ledger, a delayed promise that any clever man might explain away.
But Honora had seen his face at the window.
She had seen Cressida's fear flicker beneath her smile. She had seen Tobias recognize both.
At the far end of the gallery, Lord Rupert appeared in the doorway.
He was laughing when he entered, but the laugh died as soon as he saw Honora seated beside the ledger, and the Duke standing at her shoulder.
His face changed before he could command it.
Honora lowered the blue pencil to the unpaid line and made a neat, careful mark.
The opera gave London permission to stare.
At the gallery on Bond Street, people had pretended to examine paintings while measuring Honora's composure.
At Her Majesty's Theatre 2 evenings later, they abandoned pretense behind opera glasses and velvet curtains.
Every tier of boxes glittered with jewels, pale gloves, dark coats and faces arranged
into expressions of cultural devotion that did not prevent a single eye from drifting toward Lady Honora Ellsworth when she entered with her mother, Aunt Matilda, and Lord Selborne.
She felt the attention before she saw it. It moved across her shoulders like a cool draft.
Women who had once passed her without a greeting now leaned forward to identify the shade of her gown, the set of her hair, the absence or presence of triumph. gentleman looked briefly, then looked away, as if curiosity became ungentlemanly, only after being satisfied. Honora wore blue-gray silk, modest, well-cut, and not new. Her mother had suggested pearls. Aunt Matilda had suggested defiance. Honora had chosen neither. She had chosen a clean ribbon at her wrist, and the blue enamel pencil secured inside her reticule, because she had learned that small useful things deserved protection after careless hands had nearly cost her one. Chin level, Aunt Matilda murmured as they reached their box. Not high. High looks defensive, level looks ancestral. I was not aware my chin had lineage, Honora said. Every woman's chin acquires lineage the first time society tries to lower it. Lady Selborne, already pale from the number of people watching, gave her sister a warning glance. Matilda, I am being helpful. You are being yourself. At my age, Augusta, that is the same thing. Honora took her seat and looked toward the stage, though the curtain had not risen. The orchestra tuned below, a restless shimmer of sound. Gaslight warmed the gilding. The air held perfume, wax, damp wool from cloaks, and the faint human heat of a crowded house. For a few moments, she succeeded in thinking only of the music to come. Then, Lady Cressida Vane entered the opposite box with Lord Rupert Ainslie beside her. Cressida wore white silk tonight, a color so innocent it became an accusation. Rupert bent toward her with the same easy attention he had once offered Honora, across dinner tables and card rooms. From that distance, his smile looked untroubled. Honora knew better now. She had seen his face at the gallery door when he found her seated beside Lady Pembury's ledger. She had seen fear before charm covered it. Rupert looked across the theatre and raised his opera glass, not openly at first. He aimed it toward the stage, adjusted it, then let the lenses settle upon Honora. She refused to move. Cressida noticed and lifted her own glass with a smile. Honora felt suddenly like an exhibit placed beneath light. Do not reward them, Aunt Matilda said without looking away from her program. I am not certain how one fails to reward an opera glass. By becoming more interested in the opera than in being observed. The opera has not begun. Then become interested in your gloves. Honora almost laughed, but her breath caught when the curtain behind their box shifted, and a footman announced quietly, His Grace the Duke of Locksley. Lady Selborne rose so quickly that her fan slipped from her lap. Tobias Fairbairn entered with Lord and Lady Weatherby, distant relations of Aunt Matilda, and therefore acceptable company for a shared box. He bowed first to Lady Selborne, then to Lord Selborne, then to Aunt Matilda. Only then did he turn to Honora. Lady Honora, Your Grace. She curtsied as much as the narrow space allowed. I did not know you attended tonight. I had considered staying away. Did the music persuade you? No. His gaze passed once toward the opposite box, where Rupert had lowered his glass too late. A more practical reason. Aunt Matilda's mouth twitched. Lady Selborne looked alarmed by practicality spoken in public. Tobias took the seat behind Honora, and slightly to her left, close enough for conversation when the music allowed, proper enough that no matron could sharpen it into scandal. The first act began. Voices rose from the stage, lush and dramatic, but Honora absorbed little of the plot. She was aware of the Duke's stillness behind her, of the weight of his attention when Cressida's glass lifted again, of Rupert's restless posture across the theatre. To be watched by society felt like being judged. To be watched by Tobias felt like being guarded from a distance he would not presume to cross. During the interval, the theatre became a hive of movement. Gentlemen left boxes to greet acquaintances. Ladies exchanged bows, remarks, and carefully sheathed insults. A note passed from a footman to a box below. Cressida leaned close to Rupert, whispered something, and laughed. Rupert's eyes moved to Honora. Then he drew a folded note from his coat and placed it beneath Cressida's fan with a motion so practiced it nearly disappeared. It did not disappear from Tobias. Honora sensed him lean a fraction forward. Did you see? She asked softly. Yes, his answer came at once. A private note. A private note passed as if it must not be noticed. She looked ahead. There are many things in London that must not be noticed. And yet, you notice them. That is not always a gift. No, he said. Sometimes it is a burden other people resent you for carrying. The words were too close to truth. Honora looked down at her gloved hands in her lap. Society had always praised agreeable blindness in women. A woman might be charming if she failed to see debts, infidelities, hypocrisies, weakness, cruelty. She might be beloved if she laughed lightly and looked away at the correct moment. Honora had never mastered that. She had tried. Heaven knew she had tried. But ledgers called to her with their quiet demands, expressions which betrayed what words concealed. Promises left stains when broken. There are times, she said, keeping her voice very low, when I think men prefer women who do not ask what a silence contains. Some men do. And you? Tobias did not answer quickly. On the stage below, attendants moved scenery while the audience hummed with talk. Across the house, Rupert had stepped out of his box, perhaps toward the corridor. Cressida remained seated, turning the folded note beneath her fan as if testing its edges. I prefer truth, Tobias said. I do not always enjoy it, but I prefer it. That sounds lonely, it often is. The admission was plain. It carried no appeal for sympathy, that made it heavier. Honora turned her head enough to see him. The strong line of his face was half shadowed by the curtain, his expression controlled, but not cold. She remembered what he had said at the gallery. Stillness is not emptiness. It occurred to her that the sentence might have been self-knowledge before it was comfort. Your Grace, she said, may I ask something improper enough that my aunt will pretend not to hear? Aunt Matilda turned a page of her program. I have never heard anything in my life. Tobias's gaze warmed by the smallest degree. You may ask. Why did you come tonight? He looked toward the opposite box again. Because last evening at the gallery, Lord Rupert looked less like a man offended by gossip than a man afraid of discovery. Honora's fingers tightened. And I am the discovery, perhaps. Or perhaps you are the person he fears will make one. She breathed slowly. The wound in that thought was old and new at once. That is a strange promotion. I was uninteresting 3 nights ago. You were called uninteresting by a man who may benefit from your silence. Honora swallowed. The music of the theater, the glow, the rustle, all seemed to recede until only that sentence remained. I have spent years trying to be useful, she said before prudence could stop her. Useful daughters do not demand too much. Useful women do not embarrass their families by wanting what they cannot have. Useful spinsters manage committees, remember birthdays, sit with old aunts, and make themselves available when younger women need someone less dazzling beside them. A useful woman is easier to keep than a beloved one. The confession left her lips and frightened her. She looked away at once. Forgive me. I should not have said that. Tobias said nothing for a moment. He did not rush to soothe her, which would have been unbearable. He allowed the truth to stand between them without treating it as a stain. You should not have had reason to learn it, he said. Honora felt the words settle in a place no compliment had ever reached. Across the theater, Rupert re-entered his box. Cressida did not look at him as she tucked the folded note into the small beaded purse at her wrist. Then she lifted her opera glass once more. But this time she did not look amused. She looked intent. The bell rang to call the audience back to order. People returned to their seats. In the narrow passage outside the box, a gentleman's voice sounded too near. Rupert. Lady Honora has become very visible, he said, low but not low enough. Visibility is dangerous for a woman with family accounts to protect. Another male voice answered, indistinct. Honora went still. Tobias rose before she could turn. He did not stride. He did not threaten. He merely stepped into the passage with the authority of a door closing. Lord Rupert, he said. The corridor quieted. Rupert's reply came after a beat. Your Grace, I didn't realize this was your box. No, Tobias said. That appears to be a recurring weakness. Lady Selborne pressed one hand to her throat. Aunt Matilda's eyes gleamed. Honora remained seated, pulse sharp. The words family accounts echoing with the clerk's frightened face and the unpaid pledge. A moment later, Tobias returned, calm as ever, but his gaze went first to Honora, not to the stage. You are not required to pass that corridor alone tonight, he said. It was not a command. It was not pity, it was an offering made with care. Honora nodded once. Thank you. The second act began, but the story on stage no longer mattered. In the opposite box, Cressida's gloved hand rested over her beaded purse, guarding the folded note. In Honora's reticule, the blue pencil lay secure. Between them, across a theater full of music and watching eyes, something quiet and dangerous had begun to take shape. Loxley House did not announce its power with extravagance. It stood in Grosvenor, square behind iron railings and clean stone steps, broad, pale, and severe. With windows that seemed less designed to welcome London than to judge whether London deserved admission. Honora had passed such houses all her life, and understood them as one understood portraits of monarchs, familiar from a distance, and not meant to be touched. Yet 3 days after the opera, she stepped through the black front door with Aunt Matilda at her side, and the blue enamel pencil tucked safely in her reticule. The invitation had been proper. His Grace, the Duke of Loxley, wished to consult Lady Honora Ellsworth and Mrs. Matilda Farrow regarding certain charitable accounts connected to Lady Pembury's exhibition fund. Lady Selborne had nearly dropped the letter. Lord Selborne had read it twice, then declared that charity was a noble matter, and rank should not be ignored when rank requested assistance. Aunt Matilda had merely said, "Wear the grey. It makes you look as if nonsense has failed against you." Now, as a footman led them across a marble hall, wide enough to hold the silence of several generations, Honora felt the old caution return. A duke's attention in a ballroom could be dismissed as gallantry. A duke's call could be called curiosity. But an invitation into his London house, even with a chaperone, even for charitable ledgers, had weight. Society would not fail to add it to the growing account kept beside her name. Aunt Matilda leaned close. Do not look so solemn. Men become tiresome when they believe their houses have overwhelmed us. It is a very overwhelming house. Then we shall survive it out of spite. Honora's mouth almost betrayed her. Before she could answer, the library doors opened, and Tobias Fairbairn came forward to receive them. He wore a dark morning coat, and no unnecessary ornament. In daylight, without music or watching tears of society, he seemed not less powerful but more human, and that unsettled her in a different way. Mrs. Farrow, Lady Honora, he bowed with exact courtesy. Thank you for accepting. Aunt Matilda looked past him into the library, where a tea tray waited beside a long table, arranged with ledgers, folded notes, and a locked dispatch box. Your Grace, I have been promised accounts. At my age, I require either accounts or scandal to justify leaving my chair before luncheon. I can offer the first, Tobias said. I hope to prevent the second. His gaze touched Honora briefly. Not possessively, not publicly. Simply as if she were the one person in the room whose understanding mattered. The library was lined from floor to ceiling with books, but it was not decorative learning. Many volumes were worn. Papers were stacked in purposeful groups. A large globe stood near the window, beside a reading chair that bore the faint impression of frequent use. Honora had seen libraries designed to impress guests. This one looked as if it had been built for questions. Tobias seated Aunt Matilda by the fire with tea, then drew out a chair for Honora at the table. He did not hover while she sat. That, too, was a form of respect. Lady Pembury allowed these copies to be sent this morning, he said, placing one ledger before Honora. Her note states that your eye is quicker than her patience. Lady Pembury flatters herself. Her patience is formidable, and your eye, often inconvenient. Good. I have little use for convenient truth. Honora opened the ledger, grateful for the task, because it gave her hands a purpose. The pages smelled faintly of paper, dust, and ink. Neat columns recorded names, promised sums, received drafts, dates, and remarks. She recognized several entries from the gallery. Cressida Vane's family pledge remained pending, though the line had been marked as expected after quarter day. Brackmere appeared twice. The first entry, from the Marquess, had been fulfilled in part. The second, in Lord Rupert's hand, promised a separate edition for widows of retired estate servants. not received. Attached to the page was a folded note copied by Lady Pembury's secretary. Honora read it once, then again, a faint unease moved through her. Something? Tobias asked. The note is gracious. Aunt Matilda snorted softly from the fire. That is rarely a defense. Honora glanced at her, then back at the page. It says, one would hate to see useful work become untidy through excessive seriousness. Tobias's expression did not change, but his attention sharpened. Honora felt it like a candle drawn closer to a sealed letter. You have heard the phrase before. Not precisely. But Lady Cressida said something similar at the exhibition. Charity work can become so untidy when ladies take it too seriously. You remember exact phrasing. I remember tones that pretend not to wound. The words came out quieter than she intended. Tobias heard them. He always heard what she should have hidden. Instead of answering too quickly, he drew another paper from the dispatch box and set it before her. This was delivered to Lady Pembury 2 weeks ago, said to be in Lord Rupert's hand. The original remains with her. This is my copy. Honora studied the slant of the letters. At first glance, the hand resembled Rupert's elegant stroke, especially in the capitals. But the lower letters wavered where confidence should have been smooth. The loops were too decorative. Rupert had crossed his name from her card, with hard, impatient pressure. This note flowed in a lighter rhythm. A woman's hand attempting masculine ease, perhaps. Or a clerk's. Or someone who knew enough to imitate and not enough to inhabit. This is not proof, she said. No, but it is not nothing. No, and you already suspected it. I suspected Lord Rupert was concealing trouble. I did not know whether he had assistance. Honora looked up. You mean Lady Cressida? I mean I have learned not to accuse charm before charm has exhausted its disguises. Aunt Matilda set down her cup. That is the saddest sensible sentence I have heard this season. Tobias's gaze lowered briefly to the ledger. For the first time since Honora had known him, silence seemed to draw something from him, rather than protect him. My mother admired sparkling people, he said. She filled this house with them when I was young. They praised what should have been questioned. They laughed where honesty would have helped. They made ruin sound fashionable until the bills came due and everyone claimed surprise. Honora did not move. The library fire shifted, settling one log against another. I am sorry, she said. Do not be, it was an education, a costly one. His eyes met hers, yes, the single word held more than confession. It held a boy in a house too grand for truth, a young man learning that beauty could conceal rot, and a duke who now trusted ledgers more readily than smiles. Honora understood then that he had not noticed her because she glittered, he had noticed because she did not. I have learned to mistrust sparkle, he said. The sentence should have sounded cold. It did not. It sounded lonely. Honora looked down before compassion could become visible enough to embarrass them both. Her blue pencil lay beside the ledger. She had taken it out without thinking, prepared to mark the suspicious phrasing. May I? Please, she drew a small line beside the copied phrase. Tobias reached at the same moment to steady the page against the breeze from the window. Their hands came near enough that the fine hairs at her wrist seemed to wake beneath her glove. They did not touch. He withdrew first, and the restraint felt more intimate than carelessness would have been. Honora made the mark. The blue line stood vivid against the cream paper. If Lady Cressida helped create this note, she said, forcing her voice back into usefulness. She may have done it to delay embarrassment while Lord Rupert arranged a better match. With her, her dowry is considerable, and Lord Rupert's need may be equally so. He mentioned my father's accounts. I know. The two words came too quickly. Honora's pencil stilled. Do you? Tobias leaned back, jaw tightening almost imperceptibly. The clerk, outside Ellsworth House, works for a firm that has handled several family settlements, including matters connected to Brackmere. He was not there by accident. You had him followed? No. I had him identified. That sounds very near the same thing, it isn't. But I accept the rebuke. She had not expected that. Men rarely accepted rebuke without making a woman pay for it later, in tone or distance. Tobias simply watched her, allowing disagreement to stand between them without resentment. Honora softened despite herself. I am not ungrateful. You are not required to be grateful for being informed late. Aunt Matilda gave a satisfied little hum from the fire. I begin to like this house. Honora ignored her, because if she smiled, the moment would become too tender. What do you believe Lord Rupert wants? Tobias looked toward the marked page. Silence. Time. Perhaps a bride with money before anyone asks why promised sums have not appeared. And what does Lady Cressida want? To win. Honora felt the simplicity of it. Cressida did not merely want Rupert. She wanted proof that Sparkle triumphed over steadiness. That the room had been right to laugh. That a woman like Honora could be dismissed without consequence. The thought hurt less than it clarified. Then she will not stop at hints, no? Tobias said. I do not believe she will. A footman entered with a fresh coal scuttle, saw the papers, and withdrew with admirable speed. The ordinary interruption restored the walls around them. They were a duke, a lady, and a chaperone in a library, proper, contained, yet the air had changed. Honora gathered the pages into neat order. Lady Pembury should write to the Brackmere steward, not to Lord Rupert. She has done so, already, at your suggestion in the gallery. I did not suggest it. You made it unavoidable. There is a difference. Honora held his gaze. Your Grace, why involve me? Because you saw the break in the pattern before anyone else cared to look. That is not a safe reason to invite me here. No. Then why? He took the blue pencil from where it rested by the ledger, and held it out to her, balanced across his palm as carefully as he had held it in the ballroom. Because some people are punished for noticing what others wish to hide. I would rather they not be punished alone. Honora took the pencil. This time their gloved fingers touched. Barely. Briefly. Enough. The contact passed and left her foolishly aware of the space it had occupied. Aunt Matilda rose with deliberate noise. I believe I have supervised enough danger for one morning. Tobias stepped back at once, all propriety restored. Mrs. Farrow, I am grateful for your endurance. So you should be, Your Grace. I charge heavily in tea. As they prepared to leave, Honora placed the marked copy inside the folder Tobias gave her to return to Lady Pembury. Near the doorway she looked back once at the ledger, the blue mark, the dispatch box, and the man who had trusted her with them. Outside Loxley House, a carriage rolled past too slowly. Through the window, Honora glimpsed Lord Rupert's pale face before he pulled back into shadow. Tobias saw it too. His expression did not harden. It became still, which she was beginning to understand was far more dangerous. By the time Lady Pembury's supper arrived, Honora understood that scandal did not always enter a room shouting. Sometimes it arrived on cream paper, folded once, carried by a footman, and placed upon a silver salver, with a seal so respectable that no one thought to question the poison inside. The invitations itself had been ordinary enough. Lady Pembury requested the pleasure of Lord and Lady Selborne, Lady Honora Ellsworth, and Mrs. Matilda Farrow at a small supper following an evening of music and cards. Small, in Lady Pembury's language, meant 40 guests instead of 80, all selected for importance, appetite, and their talent for appearing accidentally present when reputations shifted. Lady Selborne insisted that refusing would look guilty. Lord Selborne said little, but his face had grown older since the Duke of Loxley's interest turned their quiet house into a subject of whispered arithmetic. Aunt Matilda advised Honora to wear ivory because Malice disliked clean lines. Honora wore pale ivory silk with blue ribbon at the waist, and she fastened the enamel pencil to the cord inside her reticule before leaving. It had become foolishly important that it remain with her. Lady Pembury's dining room glowed with candlelight and mahogany. The supper table had already been cleared when Honora entered the drawing room, leaving behind the scents of wine, sugared almonds, roasted fowl, and oranges. Groups had formed near the fireplace and card tables. Conversation moved lightly on the surface, but beneath it Honora felt the current waiting. Lord Rupert Ainslie stood near the mantel, his posture relaxed, his smile restored. Lady Cressida Vane, sat beside Lady Pembury's niece, with the air of a woman too innocent to know she had chosen the most visible seat in the room. Tobias Fairborn was there as well. His presence steadied Honora before she could stop herself from seeking it. He stood with Lord Wetherby near a pier glass, dark coat, severe, against the gold-framed reflection, his gaze touching her face for one silent second, before returning to gentlemen and speaking to him. It was not a greeting, it was an assurance. Honora took a breath and reminded herself that assurance was not ownership. She was not a frightened creature being passed from one powerful hand to another. She had walked into this room by choice. Lady Honora, Cressida called, smiling as if friendship had survived every blow she had aimed at it. You must join us. We were speaking of dance cards. Such sentimental little records, are they not? Aunt Matilda's fan paused. Honora felt the first thread tighten. They are useful, she said. Sentiment is optional. Rupert laughed softly. There speaks Lady Honora. Always loyal to usefulness, several guests smiled, not yet certain whether they were permitted to laugh. Tobias did not move, but the room seemed to feel him listening. Cressida lifted something from her lap. It was a dance card. Not Honora's own card, for that remained in the small box on her dressing table at Ellsworth House. Yet it was close enough in shape, color, and ribbon that a less careful eye might have accepted it. A line had been drawn through Rupert's name, rougher than his own hand had made it. Beneath the crossed line in faint pencil were words Honora had never written. Ask his grace, let him see, let him pity. The room chilled. Honora stared at the false card, and for a moment the candles seemed too bright. How curious, Cressida said. It was found after Lady Harbury's ball. I didn't wish to mention it, of course. But with so many rumors placing His Grace and Lady Honora together, one wonders whether the famous rescue was quite as accidental as it appeared. Lady Selborne made a small, wounded sound. Lord Selborne's face flushed with confusion and anger. Lady Pembury sat very still, her eyes on the card, her mouth compressed. Rupert stepped forward with the expression of a man reluctantly performing virtue. Lady Honora, I beg you to understand that I take no pleasure in this. I had hoped to spare you. How generous, Aunt Matilda said. No one acknowledged it. Rupert continued, addressing the room more than Honora. I withdrew from our dance because I believed it kinder. I had sensed a certain expectation from Lady Honora that I could not honor. When His Grace then stepped in, naturally people misunderstood. Now this card suggests. He stopped delicately, which was more damaging than completion. Honora felt every eye turned toward her. There it was again, the public wound. Only this time it had been dressed as evidence. The first insult had made her dull. This one made her calculating. Tobias crossed the room with terrifying calm. May I see the card? Cressida hesitated. A smaller woman might have clutched it. She did not. She handed it to him with a wounded look that suggested honesty was a burden she bore for everyone's good. Tobias examined it. Honora watched his face, but he gave nothing away. This is not Lady Honora's hand, he said. Rupert spread his hands. Your Grace is very loyal. No, I am literate. A stir moved through the room. Rupert's mouth tightened. Tobias held the card by one edge. The pressure changes between phrases. The lower letters are disguised. The line through your name is not the same line I saw upon Lady Honora's card that evening. Cressida's eyes widened with almost perfect hurt. You examined her card so closely. I examined a public humiliation while it happened. Silence. Rupert recovered first. Perhaps the card is not conclusive. I would gladly let the matter die if Lady Honora would only admit that the evening overwhelmed her judgment. There is no shame in a lady being flattered by a duke's kindness. Honora felt the trap open at her feet. If she denied too strongly, she would look desperate. If she remained silent, guilt would clothe itself in dignity and call itself proof. Tobias turned toward her, and in his eyes she saw an offer forming before he spoke. Lady Pembury, he said, voice clear enough to settle the room. This matter has become indecently public. I am prepared to end speculation now. If Lady Honora consents, I will announce our engagement this evening. The world stopped. Her mother gasped. Lord Selborne gripped the back of a chair. Rupert's expression broke open for a single instant. Cressida's fan dropped against her lap. Tobias stood before them all, powerful enough to turn scandal into triumph with one sentence. Every practical voice Honora had ever obeyed screamed that she should accept. An engagement to a duke would silence Rupert, protect her family, and make last week's humiliation collapse beneath rank. Her father's debts would no longer look like danger. Her mother's anxious years would end. Society would praise what it had mocked, because society adored correction when correction wore a coronet. Tobias looked at her, and what frightened her most was that he would do it. Not carelessly, not theatrically. He would bind his name to hers in front of everyone if she gave him the smallest permission. It should have felt like rescue. Instead, an old pain rose in her throat. Another public decision. Another man writing over her life while the room watched. Different motive, different man. Same vanishing. Honora stood. Her knees felt uncertain, but her voice did not. No, Your Grace. The room did not breathe. Tobias's eyes changed. Not anger, not offense. Pain quickly mastered. Lady Honora, her mother whispered. Honora looked at him because he deserved that. I know what you are offering. I know what it would cost and what it would spare me. But I will not exchange one humiliation for another. A woman near the fire drew in a sharp breath. Honora turned then slowly, so the room would not mistake her refusal for panic. I did not write those words. I did not ask His Grace to pity me. I did not arrange to be insulted, abandoned, or noticed. Lord Rupert chose his cruelty. Lady Cressida chose to display that card. If society requires a woman to accept a false engagement before it believes she did not invent her own degradation, then society is not defending honor. It is merely changing the shape of the insult. Lady Pembury's eyes sharpened with approval, so quick it almost vanished. Rupert went pale. Cressida's lips parted, but no sound came. Tobias lowered the false dance card. For a moment, Honora thought he might speak again. Instead, he bowed his head slightly. Not surrender, respect. Then we will not use a lie to answer one, he said. The words steadied her so deeply that she almost trembled. Lady Selborne pressed a handkerchief to her mouth. Aunt Matilda's face held something fierce and bright. Rupert tried to laugh. Very noble, very moving, but the card remains. A false card remains, Tobias said. And false things often have makers. Careful, Your Grace. Rupert's voice sharpened before he smoothed it. An accusation from a duke can ruin people. So can an accusation from a coward, Honora said. The sentence left her before prudence could restrain it. This time, no one laughed. The room had begun to understand that something more serious than flirtation had entered. Cressida rose, gathering the card back from Tobias, with a delicate shiver of outrage. I cannot remain to be insulted for attempting kindness. Then don't attempt it again, Aunt Matilda said. Lady Pembury finally stood. Enough. This is my room, and I will not have charity, honor, or supper turned into theater without my permission. The matter will rest tonight. It did not rest, it merely sank beneath the surface. Guests shifted. Conversations resumed in broken fragments. Honora curtsied to Lady Pembury, then to Tobias, because if she looked at him too long, she might show more gratitude than dignity could survive. She crossed to the side table, where her reticule lay beside her gloves. Her fingers searched automatically for the blue pencil. The cord was there. The reticule was closed. But when she opened it, the pencil was gone. For one moment, the room disappeared. Then she looked up. Across the drawing room, Tobias was watching Rupert. He had seen her face change. His own expression became very still. Honora closed her reticule with care, hiding the sudden cold in her hands. The false card had not been the end of the attack. It had been the beginning. The loss of the blue pencil frightened Honora more than the false dance card had. Because the false card had been a performance, and the missing pencil was a hand reaching into her private world. She said nothing in Lady Pembury's drawing room. She curtsied, allowed Aunt Matilda to take her arm, and endured the journey back to Ellsworth House, with her mother's trembling questions pressing against the carriage walls. Only when she reached her own chamber did she open the reticule again and search every seam beneath the candlelight. The cord remained, neatly cut close to the knot. Whoever had taken it had not snatched in haste, they had planned. The next morning London behaved, as London always did after a scandal. It dressed cruelty in concern and sent it out with calling cards. By breakfast, Lady Selborne had heard that Honora had pursued the Duke. By noon, Lord Selborne had been warned by a club acquaintance that his daughter's name was being linked with ambition, family debt, and feminine scheming. By afternoon, a note arrived from a lady who had never liked Honora enough to be direct. It said that sensible women ought to avoid the appearance of hunger. Honora folded the note once and placed it beside the cold toast on her plate. "I am being turned from dull into dangerous," she said. Aunt Matilda poured tea with a steady hand. "That is progress in a limited way." Lady Selborne looked as if she might weep. "Matilda, please, no, Augusta. If they cannot dismiss her, they must accuse her. It means they have discovered she cannot be made invisible as easily as they hoped." Honora wanted to be comforted by that. Instead, she thought of Tobias's face when she had refused his proposed engagement. Respect had been there, so had pain. She did not regret her answer, but she feared the consequence of it. Rank had been offered like a shield, and she had set it aside. Now every whisper struck skin. At Locksley House, Tobias Fairbairn read the same rumors in fewer words, and with more useful anger. He did not crumple the note sent by Lady Pembury's niece. He placed it flat on the library table beside the copy of the false dance card, the charity ledger, and a written account from a footman who had served at the supper. Anger, his father had once told him, was the least intelligent form of power. Tobias had believed that for many years. That morning, he discovered the statement was incomplete. Anger became intelligent when it was forced to be patient. "The pencil was taken after the card was shown," he said. Lady Pembury sat opposite him, her sapphire brooch gleaming like an eye. "Or before, if the false card was made with another instrument. No, Lady Honora used the blue pencil at your exhibition. Several people saw it. If the forged note appears in that shade now, the thief means to make her own object condemn her." Lady Pembury's mouth tightened. "I dislike being used as a stage for cowards. Then help me remove the curtains." By 5 o'clock, the first thread came loose. A maid from Lady Pembury's household, pale with terror and loyalty, fighting in her face, admitted that she had seen Lady Cressida Vane standing beside the small table where reticules and gloves had been placed after supper. "I didn't think it meant anything, Your Grace," the girl whispered, twisting her apron in her hands. "Ladies touch one another's things when gloves are tangled, and her ladyship only said she'd mistaken the purse for her own." "Did she open it?" Tobias asked. The maid looked at Lady Pembury, then back at him. "Only a little, I saw blue ribbon, sir. Then Lord Rupert came near the door, and I was called away." "You have done well," Lady Pembury said sharply, which in her language meant kindly. "No one will dismiss you for telling the truth in my house," a footman confirmed the next piece. He had carried wine to the card room passage and heard Lord Rupert speaking with Lady Cressida behind the half-closed door. "Not every word. Enough." "He said the lady was too steady," the footman reported, eyes fixed on the carpet. "Said steady women, notice what pretty ones are too clever to count." Then Lady Cressida said, "No one would believe a quiet woman once she looked hungry." Tobias felt the old coldness settle over him. Not indifference, control. "And the pencil? I saw her ladyship pass something small to Lord Rupert. Blue, I think. I can't swear it, Your Grace." "Do not swear more than you know." "No, Your Grace." Lady Pembury leaned back. "There is your theft, but not yet your proof." "No," Tobias said, "not yet." The proof began to take shape that evening in a gaming room off St. James's Street, where gentlemen spoke more freely after claret, and fewer ladies were present to be ruined by what they heard. Tobias did not belong to Rupert's circle, which made his presence inconvenient. His title made it impossible to challenge. He stood near a side table, apparently discussing a racing subscription with Lord Wetherby, while Rupert stood by the fire with two men of his own age, and a glass he had emptied too quickly. Rupert's voice was light, but the laughter around him was not. He owed money. Men who owed money laughed as if sound could fill the gap. "Locksley has made a sanctified project of her," one gentleman said. "Lady Honora, I mean," Rupert smiled without warmth. "Dukes enjoy peculiar charities." She looked calm at Pembury's. "Calm is easy when a woman has spent her life practicing absence." Rupert lifted his glass. "Boring women are useful until they begin to think." Lord Wetherby's conversation stopped. Tobias did not move at once. If he had crossed the room in that instant, the anger in him would have become spectacle, and spectacle would help Rupert. Instead, he set down his untouched glass. The soft click carried no farther than the side table, but Lord Wetherby heard it and stepped slightly aside, as if making room for consequence. Rupert continued, emboldened by his own cleverness. "Lady Honora should have accepted the Duke's little rescue. It would have suited her, useful, grateful, silent. But no, she wished to become a heroine." "Careful," one of the men muttered. Rupert turned and saw Tobias. His face whitened before he bowed. "Your Grace, I didn't see you. That seems to be your habit." The other men retreated into sudden fascination with the mantel clock. Rupert straightened, pride struggling against calculation. "If Your Grace has taken offense on Lady Honora's behalf, I regret it. I'm sure you know how private conversation can be misread." "I heard enough to read it clearly." Rupert's eyes flicked toward the door. "A gentleman might not repeat what he hears in a club. A gentleman might not say it." The words were quiet. They landed harder for it. Rupert's pleasant mask slipped. For 1 second, Tobias saw the panic beneath the polish, the debt, the envy, the fury of a man who had believed a quiet woman would remain where he left her. "You cannot prove anything," Rupert said too softly. Tobias looked at him for a long moment. "That is not the comfort you believe it is." He left before anger could ask for more. Outside, the evening air was damp, and carriage lamps blurred in the mist. Tobias stood beneath the portico and considered going at once to Ellsworth House. He imagined Honora's face when told that her stolen pencil might soon be turned against her. He imagined the fresh hurt if his arrival fed the rumor that she could not stand without him. Protection was simple when one thought only of danger. It became harder when one respected the person in danger. Still, by morning he had begun the only work that would matter. Lady Pembury sent for her maid again. Lord Wetherby wrote down what he had heard at the club. Tobias instructed his secretary to gather every copy of Rupert's unpaid pledges, without allowing gossip to outrun fact. He also sent no public note to Honora. That restraint cost him more than he expected. In the late afternoon, as rain tapped against the library windows, a sealed packet arrived from Lady Pembury. Inside lay a sheet of paper with three lines written in faint blue pencil. The words were not many, but they were enough to chill the room. "Lord Rupert was my first hope. His Grace was my better one. I never meant to be discovered." Tobias read the forged confession once. Then he read it again, not because he believed it, but because he wanted to understand the cruelty of its construction. The phrasing was too neat, too theatrical, too hungry for shame. On the lower edge of the paper, the blue mark darkened where pressure had broken the enamel pencil's delicate point. Tobias closed his hand beside the page, not on it. "Now," Lady Pembury said, standing near the fire, "they mean to hang her with her own ribbon." Tobias looked toward the rain-dark window. Across London, Honora was likely sitting in a drawing room, full of whispers, unaware that her silence was being forged into guilt. He had never trusted Sparkle. Now he mistrusted patience too, at least his own. "No," he said, "they mean to try." The forged confession reached Locksley House before dusk, but it reached Honora Ellsworth only as rumor. That was Tobias Fairbairn's first mistake. He told himself it was judgment, not fear. He told himself that if Lady Honora saw the page too soon, the hurt of it would show on her face at the charity. Preparation meeting the next morning, and Cressida would read the damage like a victory notice. He told himself that a few more hours of ignorance might spare her one more public wound. In truth, The sight of the three filfold lines in blue pencil had shaken something colder than anger loose inside him. Lord Rupert was my first hope. His grace was my better one. I never meant to be discovered. The words were not Honora's. They lacked her restraint, her precision, her refusal to plead. Yet Tobias could imagine London accepting them, because London preferred women simple. Proud women were cold. Quiet women were scheming. Wounded women were ambitious if they did not bleed prettily enough. By midnight, Tobias had sent for Lady Pembury, Lord Wetherby, and his secretary. By dawn, statements were being copied, servants quietly questioned, and messengers dispatched to the Brackmere steward. He sent no note to Ellsworth House. He wrote three, and burned them all. Each seemed to do harm in a different way. One revealed too much, one reassured too little. The last asked Honora not to attend the preparation meeting at Lady Pembury's, and the command in it disgusted him before the wax had cooled. Protection, he discovered, could become arrogance with astonishing speed when fear held the pen. So he chose action over explanation. It was efficient. It was unforgivable. At 11 o'clock, Honora entered Lady Pembury's morning room without him. She had slept badly, but no one in the room would be permitted to know it. She wore a simple lavender muslin gown and a straw bonnet trimmed with narrow ribbon. Her gloves were spotless. Her reticule was different from the one she had carried at the supper, because the old one now felt like a room that had been entered without permission. Lady Pembury stood by the table where invitations, subscription lists, programs, and seating notes had been arranged for the charity concert. She greeted Honora with a brisk kindness that made no mention of scandal, which Honora appreciated more than softness. Lady Honora, you may take the program list. I trust your eye more than my niece's enthusiasm. Then I shall try to justify your suspicion, Honora said. A few ladies looked up. One whispered behind her hand. Honora heard only the shape of it, not the words, but she knew her name by the pause that followed. She sat and began sorting the programs into neat groups. Music steadied her. Lists steadied her. Work had always been the shore she crawled toward when rooms turned unkind, but the empty space near the mantel, where Tobias might have stood had he chosen to come, seemed larger than any person. Lady Selborne had asked that morning whether His Grace was expected. Honora had said she did not know. Her mother's face had answered before her mouth could. A duke's absence was not neutral once his attention had become public. It was a verdict society could borrow. Lady Cressida Vane arrived late, all pale green silk and innocent distress. She greeted Lady Pembury, admired the flowers, and let her eyes pass over Honora, with exactly the right amount of pity. Lord Rupert came 10 minutes later, though gentlemen were not needed for the preparation of programs. He claimed to be delivering a message from the Marquess of Brackmere. He remained because Malice often found charitable work refreshing when it could perform near witnesses. Lady Honora, he said, bowing, how industrious of you, Lord Rupert. She did not rise. That small refusal pleased Lady Pembury, though her expression did not betray it. Rupert's gaze moved around the room. His Grace is not here. Honora tied one stack of programs with ribbon. You appear observant today. Only concerned. That must be tiring when newly acquired. A quiet sound moved through the ladies at the table. Cressida lowered her lashes. Rupert smiled. The smile did not reach the eyes. I merely wondered. London has been so very interested in His Grace's devotion. The word devotion struck the room like a spoon against porcelain. Honora kept her fingers steady. London is often interested when it cannot be informed. True. Still, men of great position must be careful where they attach their names. He stepped closer to the table. Even Locksley has grown tired of being made the hero of a lady's little drama. The ribbon snapped between Honora's fingers. Not loudly, not enough for most to hear. But Rupert saw it. That was the worst of it. He saw the mark land. The room waited for her to lower her eyes, to prove him right by folding into pain. Honora placed the broken ribbon aside and chose another. If His Grace has grown tired, Lord Rupert, he has managed it with more dignity than you displayed while interested. Lady Pembury's niece choked on a breath. Cressida's smile sharpened. You are very brave today, Lady Honora. Honora looked at her then. No, I am occupied. She returned to the programs, but inside something had shifted. Tobias had not come. He had not written. He had known the room would be dangerous, and had left her to discover whether he had withdrawn, or merely vanished into strategy. The difference might have mattered to him. In that moment, it did not matter to her heart. The first night had taught her the pain of being publicly abandoned by a vain man. This morning taught her the subtler pain of being privately protected by a good one so thoroughly that she disappeared from his plan. Lady Pembury dismissed the meeting before luncheon, claiming the work was complete, though several piles remained unfinished. Honora gathered her gloves and rose. At the door, Cressida paused beside her. I do hope you will attend the concert tomorrow. It would be such a pity if all this became too much. Honora looked at the delicate curve of Cressida's mouth, and suddenly the phrase struck. Too much, too serious, too untidy, too hungry. Not exact words, but the same rhythm, the same disguised blade. Honora saw again the copied pledge note at Loxley House. Charity work can become so untidy when ladies take it too seriously. Then the false confession she had not yet seen seemed to exist in her mind before she knew it. Cressida's malice had a pattern. It made hunger of dignity, ambition of injury, excess of seriousness. Lady Cressida, Honora said quietly. You repeat yourself when you lie. Cressida's fan stopped. Only for an instant, then she laughed. I haven't the faintest idea what you mean. I know, Honora stepped past her. That is why you keep saying it. She went home in silence. Lady Selborne questioned her. Aunt Matilda watched. Lord Selborne asked whether the Duke had been present, and the careful neutrality of his tone hurt more than accusation. Honora answered no. Then she went to the small writing desk in her chamber, took out a sheet of paper, and sat with her hands folded until they stopped shaking. She did not know what Tobias knew. She did not know why he had not come. She knew only that if she waited for powerful men to decide the correct hour of her courage, she would spend the rest of her life standing where others placed her. She dipped the pen. The note was brief because pain made long explanations dangerous. Your Grace, I am grateful for protection when it does not require my disappearance. Do not defend me by making me invisible again. I will attend the charity concert tomorrow. I will stand beside the work I have done. If there is truth to be answered, I ask to hear it before the room does, Honora. She sanded the page, sealed it, and gave it to a footman before courage could cool. Across London, Tobias received the note as afternoon light was failing. He read it once, standing beside his library table, then again seated. The third time, he did not read the words so much as endure them. Do not defend me by making me invisible again. The sentence found the place in him that had mistaken control for care. He saw Lady Pembury's morning room in his mind. He saw Rupert's smile. He saw Honora facing it without the facts he had withheld in order to spare her. The shame was immediate and deserved. Lord Wetherby, who had been reviewing a statement near the fire, looked up. Bad news? Tobias folded the letter with unusual care. No necessary news from Lady Honora. Yes, what does she say? Tobias looked toward the rain-washed window. He could almost see the ballroom again, the fallen pencil, the woman who had refused to be rescued by a lie. He had admired her courage when it stood against Rupert. He had failed to honor it when it inconvenienced his own fear. She says, he replied, that I have done the one thing I despise. Lord Wetherby waited. Tobias stood. I left her to stand alone. That evening at Ellsworth House, Honora laid out the plain ivory gown she would wear to the concert. Not triumphant, not meek, clean, steady. Her mother hovered by the door, twisting a handkerchief. My dear, if His Grace does not attend, then I shall attend anyway. People will talk. Honora touched the empty cord inside her new reticule where the blue pencil should have been. They already do, and if they are cruel, Honora looked toward the mirror. For once, the woman reflected there did not seem dull or dangerous. She seemed tired, frightened, and upright. That would have to be enough. Then they will have the inconvenience of doing it while I remain in the room, she said. In the quiet that followed, Aunt Matilda appeared behind Lady Selborne, and nodded once, as if a battle line had been properly drawn. Outside, London's carriages rolled through the evening mist. Somewhere beyond them, Tobias Fairborn was finally learning that love could not be proven by standing in front of a woman, if standing there cast her back into shadow. Honora did not know whether he would learn quickly enough. She only knew she would not disappear while waiting. Tobias Fairborn came to Ellsworth House before the morning had fully decided whether it meant to rain. He did not send a card and wait in comfort for permission to be arranged around him. He sent the card, then stood in the hall like any gentleman prepared to be refused, his hat in one hand, and Honora's letter folded inside his breast pocket. The butler, who had learned in recent days that dukes could bring as much disorder as salvation, conducted him to the drawing room with solemn care. Lady Selborne rose at once, startled into courtesy. Lord Selborne followed more slowly. Aunt Matilda remained seated by the window, her embroidery untouched in her lap, and studied Tobias as if he were a clause in a marriage settlement that might conceal danger. Honora stood near the mantel in the ivory gown she had chosen for the concert, though the concert was still hours away. She had dressed early because waiting in ordinary clothes had felt too much like surrender. When Tobias saw her, the apology in him altered. It did not lessen. It became more difficult because she looked calm. He had begun to understand how much pain calm could contain. "Lady Honora," he said, bowing. "I owe you an apology before I owe you an explanation." Lady Selborne glanced toward her husband. Lord Selborne looked at the floor, Aunt Matilda said. "Excellent. Explanations are often apologies wearing better coats." Honora did not smile. "Your Grace may sit. I would rather stand until you decide whether I'm welcome to remain." The contraction was slight, but it made the sentence human instead of ducal. Honora's gaze held his for a moment. "You may remain. My aunt will ensure propriety and, if necessary, injury to your pride. I've earned both." Aunt Matilda gave the smallest nod, as if he had passed the first gate and should not congratulate himself. Tobias took the chair opposite Honora only after she sat. He placed a leather folder on the low table between them, but he did not open it. "You were right," he said. "I tried to defend you by removing you from the danger. I told myself that silence would spare you. It did not. It gave Lord Rupert room to speak where I should have stood, and it denied you facts that belonged to you." Honora folded her hands in her lap. "You knew there was more than rumor. Yes, you knew they had used my pencil." His jaw tightened. "Yes, and you let me walk into Lady Pembury's morning room without telling me?" "Yes." The third yes landed hardest because he did not soften it. Honora looked down. She had expected defense, perhaps even noble reasoning. She had not expected the clean wound of admission. "Why?" she asked. Tobias drew in a measured breath. "Because when I saw the forged confession, I imagined your face when you read it. I imagined the pain showing where they could use it. Then I mistook my fear of your pain for wisdom." Silence settled over the drawing room. Rain touched the windows in scattered beads. Lady Selborne pressed a handkerchief to her mouth, but Aunt Matilda's sharp look kept her from interrupting. Honora lifted her eyes. "You do understand that women are often managed for the comfort of those who claim to care for them." "I do now, no," she said quietly. "You knew before. You simply did not recognize yourself doing it." Tobias bowed his head. "That is fair. It is not meant to be fair." "It is meant to be true. Then it's truer than fair." The answer disarmed her more than she wished. Anger required resistance to remain upright. His acceptance gave it no wall to push against. Still, she did not let herself soften too quickly. "Show me the confession." Lady Selborne made a small sound. "No, Mama. If London is to accuse me with words, I prefer not to meet them as a stranger." Tobias opened the folder. He placed the paper on the table and turned it toward her. "Lord Rupert was my first hope. His Grace was my better one. I never meant to be discovered." The blue pencil marks were faint, familiar, and obscene in their imitation of intimacy. Honora felt the room narrow. For one heartbeat, she was back at Lady Harbury's ball, watching Rupert cross out his name. Then she forced herself to read again. Not with pain, with attention. The pressure was uneven. The lines leaned too prettily. The phrasing was vulgar in its neatness, as if a person had imagined ambition, but never dignity. She reached for the paper, then stopped. "May I? It's yours to examine," Tobias said. "Though none of its words are yours," she took it. The page trembled only once. Aunt Matilda saw and began speaking loudly to Lady Selborne about the vulgarity of badly made tea, offering Honora the mercy of sound. Honora read the false confession a third time. "This is not Rupert." Tobias leaned slightly forward. "No, Lord Rupert's cruelty is lazier. He wounds and expects the room to do the work afterward. This is staged. It wants to be repeated." Aunt Matilda's embroidery lowered. "A woman's hand? Not necessarily in shape," Honora said. "In appetite." Tobias's eyes sharpened. "Lady Cressida, listen to the words. First hope, better one, discovered. It is the same pattern she uses whenever she speaks of me. She makes dignity sound like hunger. She makes work sound like scheming. At the opera, she said ladies who take charity too seriously make things untidy. At Lady Pembury's, she said I quietly hungered for rank. Yesterday she said it would be a pity if it all became too much." Honora placed the confession beside the copied pledge note from Locksley House. Tobias had brought that too, along with the altered card, the ledger copy, Lady Pembury's maid's statement, and Lord Weatherby's account from the club. "She repeats herself when she lies," Honora said. "I told her so." For the first time that morning, Tobias almost smiled. It was not amusement, it was admiration held under discipline. "I wish I'd heard that." "Been there," the near smile vanished. "Yes," she looked at him. The wound remained, but it had changed shape. It no longer asked whether he cared. It asked whether he could learn. "Do not disappear from difficult rooms on my behalf again." "I won't, and do not place me behind you when the truth concerns me." "No, I mean it, Your Grace. So, do I." Lady Selborne shifted uneasily. "But surely His Grace knows better how to manage such a confrontation." "Society listens to a duke." Honora turned to her mother with gentleness, because the fear in that sentence had raised her since childhood. "Society listened while I was insulted. It listened while I was accused. If I say nothing when I am cleared, it will remember only that I was handed back my name by a man." Tobias spoke before Lady Selborne could answer. "Lady Honora will speak first." The room stilled. Lord Selborne looked at the Duke as if he had expected authority and found respect instead. Aunt Matilda's face softened for half a second, then resumed its martial arrangement. Honora looked at Tobias. "Will you regret that if I am clumsy? No. If I am angry? No. If I refuse to be grateful enough? I hope you won't be grateful at all, for what should have been yours without question." Her throat tightened. She looked down at the papers to conceal it. "Then we must decide what to say tonight." "Tonight?" Lady Selborne asked faintly. Honora lifted the forged confession. "They will not wait. The charity concert gives them a room full of witnesses, and a cause respectable enough to hide behind. If I do not attend, they will call absence guilt. If I attend without knowing, they will call shock proof. So I attend knowing." Tobias opened the smaller packet he had kept aside. Inside lay the blue enamel pencil, its point broken but its body intact. Honora did not reach for it at once. For a moment the object looked wounded, which was absurd. It was only enamel and silver. Yet it had been dropped, returned, stolen, used and recovered, as if the whole story of her reputation could be held in one small hand. Lady Pembury's maid found it wrapped inside a discarded glove in the servants' passage, Tobias said. Cressida's maid had been seen carrying the glove, though, she claims she was told, to fetch it from the supper room. "Poor girl," Honora murmured. "She was used too." Tobias looked at her then, with an expression that made the air feel unsteady. "Even now you notice that. Being harmed does not give me permission to stop seeing other people." "No," he said softly. "It shows why you were never what he called you." She took the pencil. Their fingers touched only at the edges, but neither moved too quickly away this time. The contact was brief enough for propriety. and long enough for truth. Your grace, Aunt Matilda said, far too brightly, your hand is near my niece's hand. I am old, not blind, Tobias withdrew at once. Honora looked down, and despite everything, a small laugh escaped her. The sound changed the room. Not entirely, not enough to erase danger. But enough to remind them that scandal had not consumed every living thing. By late afternoon, the plan was set. Honora would attend the concert with her family. Tobias would meet her there, not as a rescuer arriving after the blow, but as an ally who had already shown her the wound and the weapon. Lady Pembury would be prepared. Lord Wetherby would remain close enough to witness. The full reckoning would wait until the morning, when family elders and witnesses could be gathered at Locksley House. But tonight, Honora would not be allowed to look surprised by her own accusation. At the entrance to the concert rooms, lamps glowed against the damp evening, and carriages lined the street in a shining black procession. Honora stepped down with Aunt Matilda behind her, and Tobias already visible at the top of the steps. He did not come between her and the door, he stood beside it, beside her. Rupert appeared beneath the portico before Tobias could speak, smiling with the confidence of a man who believed the final card had already been played. He bowed low. How brave of you to come, Lady Honora. Honora felt the pencil secure in her reticule, and Tobias's presence steady at her side. No, she said, only informed. Rupert's smile did not falter at Honora's answer, but his eyes moved, first to her reticule, then to the Duke of Locksley, standing beside the entrance, as if the doorway itself had acquired judgment. The concert rooms were already bright with lamps, and crowded with patrons eager to prove generosity in public. Music stands waited upon the small platform at the end of the hall. Rows of gilt chairs had been arranged with careful attention to rank, subscription, and resentment. Lady Pembury moved through the guests like a battleship disguised in satin, issuing greetings that sounded pleasant until one noticed how quickly people obeyed them. Honora entered on her father's arm, with Lady Selborne trembling at her other side, and Aunt Matilda behind them, wearing the expression of a woman who had come prepared to enjoy the ruin of someone deserving. Tobias did not offer his arm at once. That restraint touched Honora more deeply than display would have done. He had promised to stand beside her, not before her, and so he allowed the room to see that she entered under her own power. Only when they had crossed the threshold did he bow and say, Lady Honora, I'm honored you came. I said I would. Yes, he replied. And I've learned that when you say a thing, London should prepare itself. It was too grave to be flirtation, and too warm to be merely courtesy. Honora felt her mother glance sharply between them. She kept her gaze forward. Across the hall, Lady Cressida Vane stood near the subscription table, her pale green gown chosen to make every expression seem delicate, every wound she inflicted seem accidental. Her beaded purse hung from her wrist. Honora wondered whether the folded note still rested inside it, or whether it had already been placed where it could do the most harm. Lady Pembury opened the evening with a short address on the dignity of charitable work. She spoke of widows, retired servants, and the obligation of the fortunate to remember those whose labor had kept great houses standing. Honora listened closely, because the cause deserved better than becoming a battlefield for vanity. Then the first singer performed an Italian air. The room softened into admiration. For 20 minutes, beauty held the malice back. Then the interval began. Chairs shifted. Gentlemen rose. Ladies turned toward one another, and conversation resumed its quieter cruelty. Cressida approached the subscription table with Rupert beside her. She waited until several patronesses and two titled matrons had gathered near the ledger before speaking. Lady Pembury, she said, how moving the performance has been. One does hope the funds are as sound as the sentiment. Lady Pembury gave her a look sharp enough to trim ribbon. They will be, Lady Cressida. Rupert sighed with practiced reluctance. There has been some concern, has there not, about the management of the accounts. Honora placed one hand lightly upon her reticule. The blue pencil rested inside, broken point, wrapped in a small square of paper. Tobias stood several feet away with Lord Wetherby, close enough to hear, far enough not to make himself the answer. Lady Pembury replied, "Concern often appears when people wish to distract from arithmetic." "Surely no one would distract from charity," Cressida said. "But people do whisper. They say certain ladies have become very involved, very suddenly. A family in need, a duke's attention, and a subscription table can make an unfortunate picture." The words floated outward. Guests who had pretended not to listen became still. Rupert lowered his voice to a carrying softness. "No one accuses Lady Honora of intentional wrongdoing. We only fear that hope can make a sensible woman overreach." Lady Selborne swayed. Lord Selborne drew himself up, but Honora touched his sleeve before he could speak. This was not his wound to answer, not first. She stepped toward the table. Her pulse was sharp, yet her hands were steady. That steadiness had once been called dull. Tonight it was the only thing between her and the room's appetite. "Lady Pembury," Honora said, "may I look at the ledger?" The older woman turned it toward her without hesitation. "You may." Honora opened to the marked page. The widow's fund records several pledges made during February and March. Most have been paid, some are pending through household stewards. One promised addition, made in Lord Rupert's own name, at Lady Pembury's February music hail, has not been received. Rupert gave a short laugh. "My dear Lady Honora, charity clerks misplace entries every day. Then you will be relieved that I am not relying on a single entry." She turned one page. "The Marquess of Brackmere's household fulfilled part of its family pledge through the steward. Your separate promise was not included." Lady Pembury wrote to the steward after the exhibition. "His reply confirms no draft was ever instructed for your personal addition." A murmur moved through the guests. Rupert's face remained pleasant, but color rose under his skin. An oversight, perhaps. Oversights are common. Forged concern is less so. Cressida's fan stopped. Honora did not look at her yet. She continued, "Because stopping would allow the room to choose the shape of her courage for her." At Lady Pembury's supper, an altered dance card was shown. "Since then, a note has been circulated in private, suggesting that I pursued Lord Rupert first, and His Grace after. That note was written in blue pencil." "A very touching detail," Cressida said, "since everyone knows you favor one." "Yes," Honora said. "Everyone knows because it was visible at the exhibition, in this ledger, and in my reticule, before it was stolen at Lady Pembury's supper." The room sharpened. Lady Pembury's expression did not change. Tobias's did, but only Honora saw it. Pride restrained so carefully that it almost looked like pain. Rupert stepped in quickly. "Stolen is a grave word. So is confession," Honora answered. "Yet someone used both too freely." Cressida laughed softly. "Lady Honora, you make it sound as though the note were some elaborate plot. Perhaps it was merely a lady's private foolishness discovered too late." Honora turned to her. "Discovered. That is an interesting word." Cressida's lashes lowered. "Is it you favor it along with untidy, excessive, hungry and too much? You use those words whenever you wish dignity to look like ambition." Rupert's temper flashed. "This is absurd. Are we to condemn Lady Cressida for vocabulary now?" "No," Honora said. For pattern, Rupert stepped closer to the table. "There is no proof that the note was not yours." Tobias moved then, not forward enough to shield Honora, but close enough that Rupert remembered his rank. "Lord Rupert." The warning was quiet. Rupert ignored it, because panic had begun to make him foolish. "No, Your Grace. If Lady Honora insists on making public accusations, then she must answer public evidence. The note says she never meant to be discovered." Those were her words. The hall went silent. Honora felt the shift before she understood it. Tobias's gaze locked on Rupert. Lady Pembury's brows rose. Lord Wetherby turned his head slowly, like a man watching a trap close. Honora looked at Rupert. "How do you know that?" Rupert's mouth opened, then shut. Cressida went utterly still. Honora spoke again, clearly enough for the back of the room. "How do you know the exact wording, Lord Rupert? The note has not been read aloud here. Lady Pembury has not mentioned its phrasing. His Grace has not named it. I have not quoted that line." Rupert's color drained. I heard it from someone. From whom? It is everywhere. Lady Pembury's voice cut through the lie. It is not. I have a copy locked in my writing desk. His Grace has the original recovered from the packet sent to me. Only those involved in handling it know the exact line. Cressida stood. This is becoming unseemly, Aunt Matilda said. It became unseemly when cowards mistook charity for a stage. A ripple of startled approval moved through the room. Rupert looked from Lady Pembury to Tobias, then to Honora. His composure had begun to fray at the edges. The handsome ease that had once made mothers hopeful now looked like a painted screen in the rain. You are all determined to misunderstand me, he said. No, Honora replied. For the first time, I believe we understand you quite well. The words did not triumph. They landed with the weight of a door closing. Cressida reached for Rupert's sleeve, but he pulled away from her hand too quickly. Another mistake. Several women saw it. In society, cruelty might be forgiven if graceful. Panic rarely was. Tobias stepped to the subscription table. Lady Pembury, I apologize that your charitable evening has been used for private malice. Private malice becomes public when it borrows my ledger, she said. Indeed. He turned to the room. He did not raise his voice, because a duke did not need to. Since Lady Honora's reputation was damaged in public, it will be restored with proper witnesses. Those directly concerned will attend Locksley House tomorrow morning at 11. Lord Selborne, Lady Selborne, Mrs. Farrow, Lady Pembury, Lord Weatherby, Lord Rupert, Lady Cressida, and the senior members of both their families will be received. The relevant papers, statements, and accounts will be presented there. Rupert stiffened. You presume a great deal, Your Grace. I require very little, Tobias said. Only truth and attendance. Cressida's fan trembled once before she steadied it. And if one declines, Tobias's eyes moved to her. Then society will draw the obvious conclusion from absence. The room understood. It was not a threat spoken in anger. It was a line drawn by rank, evidence, and timing. Lady Pembury closed the ledger with a decisive sound. The second half of the concert will begin in 5 minutes. I suggest everyone remember why they paid to be here. The command dispersed the crowd, though not the silence. People moved back to their chairs in a state of thrilled discomfort. Honora remained by the table, one hand resting on the closed ledger. The room still watched her, but something had changed in the watching. Curiosity remained. So did judgment. Yet beneath them was a new note, unwilling and unmistakable. Respect. Tobias came no closer than propriety allowed. You spoke beautifully, he said. No, Honora answered, breath unsteady at last. I spoke clearly, his expression softened, then clearly was beautiful. She looked away before the words could undo her. Across the room, Rupert stood rigid beside Cressida. And for the first time since the ballroom, he looked like a man who understood that the woman he had dismissed had not fallen silent. She had been listening. At 11 o'clock the next morning, the grand drawing room of Locksley House held more truth than comfort. Tobias Fairbairn had arranged the room with the precision of a man who understood that power could humiliate or repair depending on where it asked people to stand. No one was hidden in corners. No one was placed like an accused criminal. Chairs had been set in a wide half circle before the long table, where the papers lay in orderly stacks. Lady Pembury's ledger, the altered dance card. Forged confession, the steward's reply from Brackmere, Lord Weatherby's written account, and the recovered blue enamel pencil wrapped in white paper. Honora entered with her father, her mother, and Aunt Matilda. She wore the same ivory gown from the concert, not because she wished to appear dramatic, but because she had learned that some battles should be finished in the clothes one chose to wear into them. Lord Selborne looked pale with fury. He had not yet found a place to put. Lady Selborne clutched her handkerchief, though she no longer looked ready to faint. Aunt Matilda carried herself as if she had waited 60 years to watch foolish people meet consequence in a well-furnished room. Lady Pembury was already seated, severe and satisfied. Lord Weatherby stood near the mantel. The Marquess of Brackmere sat with a face carved from embarrassment. Beside him, Lord Rupert Ainslie looked handsome, restless, and smaller than he had ever appeared in a ballroom. The Earl of Halford, Lady Cressida's father, stared at the carpet with the rigid misery of a man whose family name had been brought into a room not for honor, but for cleansing. Lady Cressida herself sat upright in pale blue, her expression composed, her fingers clasped too tightly around her fan. Tobias entered last. He greeted each person with exact courtesy. Then he took his place beside the table, not at its head. Honora noticed that at once. He had left the head of the matter for her. "Lady Honora," he said, "you asked to hear truth before the room did. You have. You also asked not to be spoken over in a matter that concerned your own name. If you wish to begin, the room will hear you." The silence that followed was not gentle. It was waiting with teeth. Honora rose. Her legs were steady. That surprised her. "I will be brief," she said. "Not because what happened was small, but because I have no wish to decorate cruelty until it becomes interesting. At Lady Harbury's ball, Lord Rupert crossed his name from my dance card after insulting me. His Grace asked me to dance. That should have been the end of a small public unkindness. Instead, Lord Rupert and Lady Cressida used the attention that followed to suggest that I had contrived the moment, pursued rank, and used charity work to improve my position. A false card was shown. My pencil was taken. A note was forged to make my silence look like guilt." She turned to Rupert, and for the first time since the first insult, she allowed him to see the full steadiness of her hurt. "You called me uninteresting because you believed I would not answer. You were mistaken." Rupert shifted. "Lady Honora, I never intended—" "Don't," she said. The contraction cut sharper because her voice did not rise. "Don't begin with intention when we are here because of action." Lady Pembury's eyes gleamed. Tobias looked down briefly, but Honora knew he was listening with everything in him. She sat, not because she was finished feeling, but because she was finished pleading. Tobias unfolded the first paper. "Lady Pembury's ledger records a separate pledge made by Lord Rupert Ainslie for the widow's fund. The Marquess of Brackmere's steward confirms that no such draft was instructed or paid." The Marquess turned to his son. "Rupert?" Rupert's jaw tightened. "It was delayed." "A private embarrassment, not a crime." "Embarrassment often becomes malice when a man would rather ruin a woman than admit debt," Aunt Matilda said. The Marquess closed his eyes. Tobias placed the altered card beside the ledger. This card was presented at Lady Pembury's supper. It resembled Lady Honora's card, but it was not hers. "The line crossing Lord Rupert's name differs from the original line witnesses saw at Lady Harbury's ball. The penciled words beneath it are not in Lady Honora's hand." Cressida gave a soft laugh. "Handwriting is a delicate art, Your Grace. Surely none of us are experts." "No," Tobias said. "Which is why I asked three people who had seen Lady Honora write at the charity table, and two who had seen your hand, Lady Cressida, in committee notes. None were told what answer I preferred. All found the same likeness in phrasing and form." Cressida's smile thinned. "Likeness is not proof." "No, it is pattern." He set down the forged confession. The note circulated after Lady Pembury's supper was written in faint blue pencil. The blue enamel pencil belonging to Lady Honora was stolen from her reticule that evening. "Lady Pembury's maid saw you, Lady Cressida, open a reticule that was not yours. A footman saw you pass a small blue object to Lord Rupert near the card room passage." Cressida stood. "This is outrageous. Servants misunderstand everything." Lady Pembury's voice was ice. "Servants understand more than those who depend upon not being observed." Cressida's father looked at her sharply. "Sit down." She sat, but the grace had gone out of the motion. Tobias lifted the pencil at last. The broken point glimmered dark blue against the white paper. "This was found wrapped in a glove handled by Lady Cressida's maid after the supper. The forged note bears pressure marks consistent with its broken point. That alone might be coincidence. Lord Rupert ended the possibility of coincidence last night when he quoted a line from the forged confession before it had been read aloud in any public room." The Marquess of Brackmere turned slowly toward Rupert. "You knew the wording." Rupert's face had lost all charm now. Cressida showed me the note. The room froze. Cressida's head snapped toward him. Rupert, you said it would only frighten her away from the concert, he said, panic making him careless at last. You said no one would believe she hadn't written it if it was in her own pencil. The confession fell into the room without drama, and that made it worse. No one gasped. No one needed to. The truth simply stood there, plain and ugly, stripped of silk. Cressida's fan slid from her fingers to the carpet. The Earl of Halford rose halfway, then sat again as if his knees had failed under family shame. Is this true? He asked. Cressida's eyes flashed with tears she had summoned too late. She was making fools of us. Everyone was praising her, as if being plain and steady were some kind of virtue. Rupert would have been trapped by pity, and his grace was making her important. Honora looked at her, with a sadness she had not expected to feel. No one made me important, Lady Cressida. You merely discovered that I was not as small as you required. Rupert tried to speak again. I did not mean for it to go so far. Tobias's gaze moved to him, and the room seemed to cool. You meant for it to go far enough that Lady Honora would be doubted, isolated, and shamed into silence. Rupert looked away. Tobias spoke then, each word clear. Lady Honora was not boring. She was simply too honest to flatter a coward. The sentence did not need volume. It traveled through every person present and settled where reputation lived. Lady Selborne began to cry quietly. Lord Selborne took Honora's hand, and the pressure of his fingers said what pride had kept from his mouth for years. The Marquess of Brackmere stood. His face was grey. Lord Rupert will leave London before nightfall. His allowance will be placed under my steward's supervision until every debt and charitable obligation is settled. He will write apologies to Lady Honora, Lady Pembury, and this house. Rupert stared at the floor. Yes, Father. The Earl of Halford rose next, older in one moment than he had been upon entering. Lady Cressida will withdraw from the remainder of the season. I will speak with Lady Pembury regarding the patronage she has damaged. There will be no further invitations sought while this remains unanswered. Cressida made a broken sound, but no one rescued her from consequence. That, Honora thought, was the difference between cruelty and justice. Justice did not delight, it simply refused to look away. Lady Pembury stood. The widow's fund will receive what was promised, with additions for the trouble caused to its name. It will, the Marquess said. When the formal apologies had been made, awkward and pale but public enough to matter, the room began to loosen from its terrible stillness. People rose. Chairs shifted. Lady Cressida left on her father's arm without looking back. Rupert paused near the door and bowed to Honora, the gesture stiff with humiliation. Lady Honora, I'm sorry. She studied him for 1 second. I hope someday you are sorry for what you did. Not merely for where you were forced to admit it. He had no answer. After he was gone, the drawing room felt larger. Tobias remained by the table, the blue pencil in his hand. He looked at Honora as if the room had emptied, though half its witnesses still remained. Lady Honora, he said, your name has been restored in the hearing of those who heard it damaged. I have one question more, and it is not meant as rescue. Her breath caught. Then ask it. May I court you openly with no scandal to hide behind? The room did not disappear this time. Honora heard her mother's breath, Aunt Matilda's satisfied silence, her father's startled movement. She also heard her own heart, steady and alive. Tobias did not ask like a duke granting favor. He asked like a man offering choice. Honora took the blue pencil from his hands, spart, and placed it gently on the table between them. Then write your name properly this time, she said. And for the first time in many days, the silence that followed did not wound her. It blessed her. By autumn, the name Lady Honora Ellsworth no longer produced a hush of pity in London drawing rooms. It produced a pause of calculation, which Aunt Matilda declared a vast improvement, because calculation meant people had finally learned caution. Rupert Ainslie had been sent to a Brackmere property in the north, under the stern supervision of his father's steward, where unpaid promises became ledgers, and ledgers became penance. Lady Cressida Vane had vanished from the season, with a headache that lasted, according to gossip, exactly as long as society's memory. Lady Pembury's widow's fund received its promised money, then more, after several fashionable consciences discovered generosity, once the Duke had looked at their accounts. Yet the true change did not belong to London. It waited in Oxfordshire, where Loxley Park rose from a sweep of golden fields and darkening trees with the calm authority of a house that had watched. Scandals come and go for 200 years, and preferred harvest weather to gossip. Honora arrived there with Lady Selborne, Lord Selborne, and Aunt Matilda 3 months after the morning. In the drawing room, not as a rescued lady being hidden from whispers, but as the woman the Duke of Loxley had courted openly, steadily, and with such careful respect that even the cruelest tongues and found little to sharpen. Tobias had written his name properly, first upon her dance card at the next small musical evening, then upon formal letters to her father, then upon every public act that proved he had not chosen her in the heat of scandal. He had called at Ellsworth House twice each week. He had walked with her in Hyde Park, under the strict surveillance of Aunt Matilda, who claimed she could hear impropriety at 30 paces. He had sent books instead of jewels until Lady Selborne, half alarmed and half delighted, asked whether dukes proposed with footnotes now. He had not rushed her gratitude. He had not mistaken her acceptance of care for surrender. When he asked her at last whether she would come to Loxley Park and see the life he hoped to share, Honora had said yes, because the word no longer felt like protection against being swallowed. The house received her without spectacle. The housekeeper, Mrs. Vale, curtsied in the entrance hall and spoke to Honora as if her opinion would matter by luncheon. Tobias's elderly aunt, Lady Augusta Fairbairn, examined Honora over tea, asked three alarming questions about household patronage, and then said, "Good, you answer before you flatter. This family has had enough of flattering women and frightened men." Aunt Matilda declared herself fond of Lady Augusta before the second cup. By the end of the first week, Honora had seen the old servants' cottages, the schoolroom used for tenants' children, the neglected music room, the chapel, and the west garden, where late roses clung to their last color. She had also seen the room Tobias had prepared for a new patronage committee. It was not large. It overlooked the south lawn and held a writing table, cabinets for records and chairs, arranged for conversation rather than display. On the desk lay a clean ledger, several blank calling cards, and a small silver tray containing the blue enamel pencil, repaired with a new point, but left with the tiny mark near its cap, where misuse had damaged it. Honora stopped in the doorway. Tobias stood beside the window, one hand resting lightly on the back of a chair. "I had it repaired," he said. "Not replaced." She crossed the room slowly and touched the pencil with one gloved finger. "Why not replaced?" "Because repair tells the truth better." Her throat tightened, but she smiled. "That is a very scholarly answer. It's also a very honest one." She looked around the room. "And this, if you wish it, a fund for overlooked gentlewomen. Companions, poor relations, unmarried daughters, with skill and no platform for it. Not charity in the ornamental sense. Patronage with records, recommendations, and actual money paid when promised."
"You make that sound like a revolution. A modest one."
Properly entered in a ledger, the laugh that escaped her was soft and disbelieving. Months earlier, usefulness had felt like the consolation prize offered to women not beloved enough to be cherished. Now, in this quiet room, usefulness became power restored to its rightful purpose. She picked up one of the blank calling cards. Lady Honora Ellsworth was written upon the top line in Tobias's neat hand, with space beneath for the future title society already whispered with a very different tone. "You know they will say I have made a crusade out of embarrassment," she said. "They will say many things. Does it not trouble you?" Tobias came no closer than propriety allowed, though they were nearly engaged enough for half of London to have married them in its imagination. Less than it once did. "I have learned that society's appetite is not the same as judgment."
"And what is judgment?"
"You, reading a ledger and refusing to let the numbers flatter anyone. She looked at him then. Outside, the autumn light warmed the lawn. Inside, the room seemed to hold the whole path from humiliation to peace, without asking her to relive every step. "I was so tired of being measured," she said. "By age, by charm, by whether a man looked twice, by whether I could be useful without becoming inconvenient." His face softened. "I know," she said, gently now. "You listened. That is better than knowing." He accepted the correction with the grave attention that had first undone her. "Then I will keep listening." That evening, Loxley Park hosted a small dinner for neighbors, tenants' representatives, and a handful of family friends. It was not a London crush. No one came to see Honora wounded or vindicated. They came because the Duke had invited them, and they remained because Honora spoke to each person as if attention were not a coin to be spent sparingly. "Mrs. Vale later confessed to Aunt Matilda that the servants liked her because she noticed work without making a performance of praising it. Lord Selborne watched his daughter discuss school accounts with the vicar and looked both proud and ashamed of how late he had learned to be proud. Lady Selborne cried only once, discreetly, when Lady Augusta asked whether Honora might advise on the winter relief lists. After dinner, when the guests had gone and the house settled into that deep country quiet London never permitted, Honora stepped into the music room alone. The room had been opened that afternoon for airing. Moonlight lay across the polished floor. A pianoforte stood near the wall, and beyond the windows, the park rolled silver under the night. She had not meant to linger, yet the emptiness of the room held no threat. Once, rooms had felt dangerous when people watched. Then they had felt dangerous when people did not. This one felt like a place where silence had finally lost its teeth. The door opened softly behind her. "May I come in?" Tobias asked. She turned. "You live here, Your Grace." "That wasn't my question," she smiled. "Yes, you may come in." He entered and paused several feet away. "Lady Augusta is instructing your aunt on the correct way to terrify a steward. I believe an alliance has formed. Then Oxfordshire may not survive us. It will be better organized." For a moment, neither spoke. The moonlight touched the side of his face, gentling the severity that London had once mistaken for coldness. Honora thought of the ballroom, the fallen pencil, the way his hand had reached first, without making pity of it. She thought of Rupert's voice and Cressida's smile, then felt the memories recede, not erased but placed where they belonged. Behind her. "Do you remember," Tobias asked, "the first dance? I remember trying not to step on your foot." "You didn't, because you were steering." "Guiding," he corrected. "There is a difference. A useful distinction." His almost smile appeared. "I have learned from an exacting teacher." She looked toward the empty floor. "There is no orchestra, no witnesses either." The words hung between them, tender because they held no demand. Honora understood what he offered. Not public correction. Not triumph. A memory returned to them, without the stain of spectators. She inclined her head. "Then, Your Grace, you must supply the music," by counting very quietly. "I'm afraid my musical gifts are limited." "Then don't be dull." His eyes warmed. "I wouldn't dare." He offered his hand. She placed hers in it. There was no gasp from a ballroom, no fan snapping shut, no man across the room realizing too late what he had lost. There was only the measured turn of two people who had learned the cost of being seen wrongly and the grace of being seen well. Tobias guided her through a slow waltz across the moonlit floor. His hand was steady. Hers did not tremble. When she smiled this time, it was not because someone cruel watched and suffered. It was because no cruelty was needed for the smile to matter. "Honora," he said softly. Her name sounded different here, not announced, not defended, known. "Yes, will you marry me?" She did not answer at once, because the question deserved to stand in the quiet, without being rushed. Then she looked at the man who had learned not to rescue her by erasing her, the man who had placed truth in her hands, and stood beside her while she used it. "Yes," she said. "But you'll have to endure a great many ledgers." "I hope to deserve them." She laughed then, fully and without caution, and the sound rose into the old room as if the house itself had been waiting for it. The world had called her boring, because it had never learned how to listen. Tobias had listened once, and never stopped.